This is the House Committee on Health and Public Advocacy. Today is Thursday, March 1st, 2001. The chair of our committee is Representative Cruz, and the administrator is Diane Lewis.
Call the meeting of the House Health and Public Advocacy Committee to order. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2396. Colleagues, if you remember back when we had a bunch of civil commitment bills that we sent to judiciary, we overlooked one. So the purpose of this work session is to send this bill to civil or to judiciary so they have the whole set. So, Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2396 be reported without recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Judiciary.
Representative Cromwell moves House Bill 2396 be reported out without recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Judiciary. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objections? Hearing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Excused.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Montanison?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 2396, having received the constitutionally required majority, is passed and referred on to the Committee on Judiciary, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2396. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2490. Diane.
Hey. Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 2490 defines community development for provisions relating to state and local commissions on children and families. We have some folks signed up. Oh, they're still signing up. Okay. In your staff, under your staff measure summaries, committee, you'll see that I gave you some information on community mobilization and that this bill actually changes the word mobilization to development.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Today we have Janet Carlson, District 32. I'll remember to do the proper protocol here. Today we have part three of the Children and Families Movement and House Bill 2004 and Senate Bill 555. And this bill that you see before you is a very simple bill in the sense that it just changes one word in the statute. Let me give you a little bit of background about that. When House Bill 2004 was passed, the vision of, as you heard from Larry Campbell when he came to talk to you, was about creating an integrated services system, one that was more accessible, one that was more holistic, one that was more sensitive to the needs of families, and one that families could actually, that was not only waiting until families fell in crisis, but working on the prevention mode as well. One of the things that I think if you talk to anybody that works in social services or in schools will tell you is that you can work in treating a child or a family in a program, and if they go back into that same community dynamics that they have been in before, it pretty much unravels all of the good things that you're trying to do with them. And so the community norms and values, the way that people treat each other in a community, what people believe about their families and children, are critical to success for healthy families and healthy communities. One of the lines that we added last session, and it's in the statutes, and I looked it up, but then I realized it's in the bill, in House Bill 2490, if you look at lines, the first page, lines 12 and 13, this was new and added last time. It says, communities provide the context for healthy children and families, and strong families and healthy communities are interdependent. So that was the belief system that we added into statute last time, and then clarifying the role of local commissions, because many local commissions on children and families, recognizing that community development work or the community building work needed to happen in order to create that system for children and families, started doing all types of initiatives to try to build community. Marion County, for example, has what they call community progress teams, and Randy Franke was here a few days back and talked to you about those. Other counties have done public awareness types of efforts. Multnomah County has done a big effort called Take the Time, where they're working with the Search Institute and the 40 developmental assets for children and families and trying to get people to mentor children. And, you know, one of their tenets is that you just need to learn the names of the kids that live on your block and say hello to them. I mean, there's a number of things that we can do to actually make our community stronger and have healthy kids and families. Let me back up here also. So in statute, what we did was we clarified that the roles of local commissions are, one, to provide wellness, and that was in statute before, two, to conduct comprehensive planning, and that was also in statute before, but three was to mobilize communities. And there's language throughout the statutes that talk about community mobilization. So legislative direction was clarified in the 1999 session in Senate Bill 555.
Which I'm going to pass out right now.
Which they're going to, yeah, Diane's going to hand you a copy of so that you can see that. One of the problems that we've had since then is that the State Commission on Children and Families has, in essence, sort of was confused about what community mobilization is. In fact, Representative Crummell sits on that commission, and he can probably tell you that there's been some discussions lately about learning more about what is community mobilization and what does it mean. Some people said they didn't like the word mobilization, that it reminded them of, you know, Peace Corps or something like, you know, what in the world does mobilization mean? So I don't frankly care what you call it. You can call it mobilization, you can call it community building, you can call it community capacity building, you can call it community development. I just think it's something that needs to happen, and it's an important thing that needs to happen. What we've done in this bill is we've added a line on line 14 that also adds to the belief system that economic opportunity and social cohesion are essential for healthy communities. One of the things that we haven't spent enough time as a policy body thinking about is how economic development really fits with human resources and education. I mean, they are really a sort of a triangle that it's required, and more social service movements and communities are looking at how do you develop neighborhoods, how does housing fit in, how do jobs fit in, and so those efforts are coming to be integrated more with the human services efforts. So it's not just around delivering services for children and families, but it's building those sustainable communities that will help families succeed. Social cohesion is the idea that I talked about before, and there was a really neat study that came out of the University of Chicago that talks about how they actually surveyed families, and those communities where people felt like they could trust their neighbors, where they were willing to go up to kids and tell them to stop writing graffiti on the wall, where they felt like their community was really important to them, they had less crime despite all the other factors that you would think that you would have for crime, despite poverty, despite single-parent families, despite racial tensions, despite almost anything else. It was the social cohesion in the neighborhood that made the difference in terms of those crime rates. So these are really important things for us, I think, to consider as a legislative body, is how does social service delivery, education, and economic development all fit together to build sustainable, healthy communities where our kids and families can also be healthy. So the only other part of the bill is basically it takes out the word mobilization and it puts in the word development. And if you choose to keep it mobilization, I will not be offended. But I just wanted to raise the issue to your attention. And I think in many ways the State Commission is becoming more aware of what mobilization is. They had a really neat meeting. And I've asked Clara Pratt if she would come here today and share with you this part of the presentation that she did for them to help them better understand this concept. She's from Oregon State University and has been doing some landmark work around developing measurable outcomes for how we can build community and do community mobilization. So with that, I'll close my introduction and see if you have any questions.
Representative Lee.
Yes, in the co-chairs budget, Representative Carlson, and I know you're also in Ways and Means Sub, is there a discussion of some funding of this program, and does it relate to the state as a whole, or would the funding just relate to specific counties?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lee. You're actually going to have a bill before you later on in this meeting that addresses that, that are some amendments that I've drafted on behalf of Representative Winters, who's the chair of the subcommittee. Right now, the local commissions on children and families receive some money for what they call local staffing, and I've got a spreadsheet where with the next bill, I'll show it to you. And they have some many other funding streams, and so what we're looking at is trying to pull some dollars together mm-hmm. that would be used for this purpose, more of a block grant approach.
Other questions?
I do have one, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Cromwell.
Representative, you made a comment that I sort of in reflecting on, you know, people in communities used to, you know, they would go up to somebody that was writing graffiti and tell them to quit, and you know, crime rates were tended to be lower. Why do you suppose that it is now that we have to put it in statute for people to work on building their communities as opposed to just people being part of their neighborhood and taking responsibility for what goes on in their neighborhoods and their school environment and their school area and their communities in general?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell. In Marion County, I did a presentation on community development, and we had some county commissioners there that asked that very question. And the response that I gave is that, you know, we used to be very much sort of embedded in our communities. We lived, worked, went to school in the same community. We knew who our neighbors were. We cared about each other's kids. And then as growth has happened, as we've become more suburban, if you will, as people live in one community and commute to another community to go to work, oftentimes our communities are more our workplace. Or, you know, we have the internet now, so we have world communities, we have communities of interest. And that idea of geographic community has sort of become lost in many ways. That's one issue, is just, you know, the growth and sort of this whole digital thing and how we've pulled together. But I think the second thing in terms of the content area that you're dealing with here in this committee is that somewhere, I was probably going to college or teaching school at the time this happened, but there was a policy decision that was made maybe 20 years ago or so that was that social services were best delivered by professionals and education was best delivered by professionals, and people really sort of were just supposed to pay their taxes and stay out of the way. And so we handed over to social workers the task of trying to help with social ills, and we handed over to our educators the task of educating our children. And we've realized after that experiment for 20 years that we can't buy enough social workers or enough educators to really to address the needs that we have in our society right now. We need people to take responsibility in their communities for their kids and families. Definitely we need professionals. I would be the last person to say that we can run an entire social service system on volunteers. But as you saw in this last meeting that we had 2 days ago with the Family Resource Centers and the Relief Nurseries, we can build marvelous community programs that make parents and the people who are involved contributors in those programs, that bring in volunteers, that embed those programs in their communities, and we have a much better system because the people who are involved in the programs feel accountable. The people who live in the surrounding community feel like these are their community members and they want to be part of that and make those people feel more connected with their community. And the professionals play a much different role of facilitating and helping and bringing people together rather than feeling that it's their responsibility to go out and fix the problem. So I think what we're doing is sort of turning around a trend that we started about 20 years ago that said, you know, really, we'll just pay people to take care of these issues and we'll stand back and just kind of be involved in our own little family and not really get involved at all.
Questions? Thank you. Clara?
Hey. Backwards.
You got a bum seat for the movie, Phil.
Well, oh, that's going to be tough.
Sorry.
Hey, Phil.
Either you're going to see very well or not at all.
I always do, yeah.
You cause some trouble down there, Representative?
Yeah, always. Whenever possible, Mr. Chair.
That's my job, to keep him in line.
Ooh.
Diane, I need you the overheads are in the on this new handout.
Good.
And I apologize for the coffee that got spilled on. But
It's an Oregon company.
Okay, well, that's okay then.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Representative Cruz, members of the committee. I am Clara Pratt from Oregon State University. I work in the area of family policy and have a long history in community collaboration issues. For many years, I worked in the field of gerontology, and there are actually, I believe, more similarities than differences when we're talking about children and the elderly in terms of how important a network of both formal supports that are appropriate to the needs and informal supports that support people day after day after day, and the connection between those two. I want to spend just a few minutes commenting at the request of Representative Carlson about this whole idea of really moving forward to understand that to really support families and healthy communities, we have to have at least three legs of a stool. The first one is economic and infrastructure expansion. Families can't do it alone. When families don't have academic training or work-related training, when they don't have adequate income, when they don't have job opportunities and housing and transportation, they suffer. And there's substantial evidence that that is the case. And we see that in Oregon, not just around the world. That does not mean that human services should be responsible for all of that, but it also means that we need to understand that the economic system and the infrastructure we create really does very directly influence families. Another piece of that three-legged stool is service systems and what we often call service system reform or service system integration. I think that the idea that the service system reform primarily targets the idea of formal services, that is what Representative Carlson was speaking of as teachers and schools and social workers and nurses and doctors and all the people that we either pay privately or publicly to provide services that are more technical and take a higher level of specialization than just day-to-day support. Community mobilization or community development targets more of the informal system. And the informal system is that the daily diet of our lives. It's the people that we work with, the places that we work, whether or not those places are supportive of the fact that we might have families. It's the faith community, it's civic organizations, it's volunteers, it's neighbors, it's the people who on a daily basis are the ones we contact. I think what's interesting about the development the last 15 or so years in the area of supports for families is an increasing recognition that you really do need all three of these and you can't just deal with one at a time. And that the more you're talking about something being universal and promoting and prevention, the more you have to recognize that somehow the informal network, families, friends, neighbors, grandparents, volunteers, business communities need to have some support and involvement in that. The more you're talking about rehabilitation and intervention and services, the more you're talking about needing professionals and a highly professionalized skilled workforce. I was struck this morning in getting ready. It's probably about the time I spilled the coffee on the corner of your handout, so again, I'll apologize for that. But I was struck this morning. I walked through the kitchen, and my husband had on the television, and we were listening to what was going on in Seattle, and he flipped the station, and there was Lauren Hutton, and I don't know how many of you know who Lauren Hutton is, but she's this beautiful model. The one with the gap in her teeth that she never got fixed because it made her outstanding as a model. And she's been on the front of Vogue and all these magazines for years. And she was talking about a really horrendous accident that she had last year on her motorcycle. Just a horrible accident in which she was thrown some distance and was airlifted to a hospital and had to have all sorts of massive interventions to keep her alive. And the brain surgery and the arms. And I mean, she was a mess. She was just a mess. And so the interviewer said to her, "Well, I bet you're thankful for all that great, those doctors and all that wonderful technical support." And she said, "I am." And then she started to cry. And she said, "I'm sorry, but what I'm even more thankful for were the 14 people who came to see me who didn't have any skill at taking care of my injuries, but who just took care of me. And it was such, for me, it was such a good example of that interface. And I think the comment that we, why don't we have it now? Well, there's probably lots of reasons why we don't have it now. One of the reasons we don't have it now is I think we have delegated too much. I think we have created a society where people don't know their neighbors and they don't get to know them very well. And sometimes it doesn't take much to do that, but we don't make that step. We do see communities mobilize around emergencies. You often see communities mobilize around emergencies. I mean, if this place starts flooding or another earthquake hits and these little things start falling down, we'll all of a sudden forget who's a Democrat and a Republican. We're going to be all helping each other get out the door or under a table. You know, I mean, so I really do think that's really true. And so to some extent, the reason that this is becoming an issue now and coming to the forefront now is that people are more and more recognizing we do have an emergency with children and youth and families. I presented to the Ways and Means Committee, Human Resources Subcommittee yesterday, and they were appalled to hear that with Healthy Start, Oregon Healthy Start, which is operating in 20 counties in Oregon, they've been screening 86% of all the first births in those counties. So this is a pretty representative sample of what's going on in the state of Oregon. 20 counties, 86% of the first births. 41% of the first births are in this state. 41% are being born to single moms. That's part of the answer. I got to tell you, Representative Winters looked at me and she said, that's got to be wrong. It's not wrong. And in fact, we lag in the nation. We're actually still behind the national average. We have, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, the support system that many of us are able to take for granted doesn't exist for everyone, and we really need to recreate that. If we think about what the components of community building are, if you look at it may be the first page of one of your handouts, but it says, what is community mobilization? What is community mobilization? It really has three actions or strategies. The first is to expand the local community capacity and conditions for change. The very first step is helping people understand that there is a need to change. There is a need to go back to saying it's good to know your neighbor. It's good to care. It's good to, if you're a business, to not just say kids should be better and doing better in school, but to look at your own policies and say, do we allow our workers an hour a month to go to their school? Do we give them time to go to school meetings? Do we make that possible? Do we have mentor programs? One of the things I like about the Search Institute's work from Minneapolis is that it does what I call hold everyone's feet to the fire. It doesn't say churches are responsible or synagogues are responsible or families are responsible or parents are responsible. It says everybody's responsible. We've all got a role to play, and we got to remember that churches need to pay attention to youth, that synagogues need to pay attention to youth, that volunteers, that neighbors, and that businesses should be saying, hey, if I want better workers and I want the kids to be graduating from high school, am I making it possible for my employees to go and have a council at school to volunteer? That's what the time movement in Multnomah County is really about. And the second piece of that expanding local capacity is about engaging people in planning and decision making and prioritizing so that the social service system feels like theirs, not ours. It isn't government's, it's theirs. That there's enough input from people that they'll say, yeah, I'm willing to support that. It's not just being done to me. And I think that dotted line between community mobilization and the social service system is a part of trying to imply that it needs to be a permeable line, that hospitals and schools and social service agencies need the input of the people who are there serving in order to offer that service in the best possible way. Certainly businesses know that, and you think about the billions of dollars that are spent on focus groups trying to figure out what consumers want and responding to that. The second strategy for community mobilization involves actually directly enhancing community supports and opportunities for children. This means creating clean playgrounds, having community gardens, having volunteer programs, leveraging resources, using, in some cases, and Marion County is a good example, where the Marion County Commission provides $13,000 to a community and says, go forth and figure out how you want to use this in a responsible way to help build your community. And typically what you see is a 7-to-1 leverage. They get the local Les Schwab and the local Safeway, and the first thing they do with that money is go put it in the bank so it starts earning interest. And they use the money in an incredibly creative ways to meet whatever they've defined as their local needs. And most often those are things like parent education programs. They may be summits on teen pregnancy or alcohol and drug use. They may be summits to bring together Hispanic and Latino youth with Anglo youth. They may be police interactions with high-risk youth. It may be an after-school program, programs and interventions that really look at what is it that's going on in this community that needs some attention. And finally, more formally linking the formal and informal services, and that is really looking at a whole range of services and supports. That can range from having a volunteer work with the local Healthy Start Project, which is locally funded, but the volunteer going to families' homes to make a visit, to bring a welcome home, welcome, sort of like what we used to have, what did they call that? The welcome wagon, exactly. To really creatively looking at where can we link people? How can we link people? In the field of gerontology, several years ago, I worked with a group that in a small rural hospital didn't have any local transportation system. It was a very small community, and so people would find that they were being dismissed from the hospital and going home. They're 86 years old, and their 87-year-old husband was coming to pick them up in the pickup. And so they said, we got to have a better transportation system for people that are leaving the hospital after, especially once we had DRGs and people are still leaving the hospital and they couldn't stand up. And they set up a whole network of volunteers to help transport frail, elderly, or any post-surgical patient home in a much safer manner. It's that kind of linkage that can really be helpful. I think the thing that's important about community mobilization is that it's truly, in its best forms, it leads to the kind of social cohesion that Representative Carlson was talking about, where people believe that they can make a difference. They believe we are all responsible for the well-being of families and community and children and youth in our communities, not just the government or the social worker or the school. And they have a way to exercise that belief. That is, there's a role that they can see that they can do, that they can pull off a piece of it that's small enough to feel some success at. And that might be volunteering or being a part of a SMART program. It's one of the, as you look at the movement towards thinking about community, I think it's interesting in the Oregon benchmarks that one of the benchmarks we have is the percentage of Oregonians who volunteer 50 or more hours a year. That is very directly a statement about engagement in the community. So I'd be happy to answer questions and make comments. I think I would like to end by saying this is not the end-all and be-all of reducing all the problems we have, but it is certainly it's a piece of creating an environment for all children and families and youth. Thank you very much.
Questions? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, do you think that probably because of the history that Representative Carlson spoke of, you know, where over the last 20 years we've sort of abdicated our own responsibilities to the government, to the social worker, to the teacher, mm-hmm. to the whoever sort of somebody else was there. And now, you know, people are kind of saying, you know, they're tired of the social workers coming in and butting into their business and they want mm-hmm. to really mm-hmm. get out and that sort of thing. So do you think in that respect that we're seeing a shift in community attitudes where people are saying, you know, we're going to take back our community and we're going to take it back you know, so some members of the community, they're saying, you know, we don't want the government doing this anymore. We want to do it ourselves, and we're going to take it back. Do you kind of see that happen?
I think what I see more and what I hear more from people that are involved in these community mobilization actions is they're saying not that we don't want the government to do this anymore, but that we don't want the government to do it alone. We realize that schools aren't the end. I mean, we don't all want to become, it's not like we want to take back the schools, but we want parent councils. So we can say, is this school feeding our kids what we want them to eat? Is this school opening at a time that makes sense for us? Is the school staying open or have some activity for the days on President's Day when I have no child care? I mean, are the high schools closing on the same days that the undergrad or the elementary schools closing so that my older kids can be home with my younger kids while I'm over taking care of my mother or working? I think project, which is locally funded, but the volunteer going to families' homes to make a visit, to bring a welcome home, welcome, sort of like what we used to have. What did they call that? The welcome wagon, exactly. To really creatively looking at where can we link people? How can we link people? In the field of gerontology, several years ago, I worked with a group that in a small rural hospital didn't have they didn't have any local transportation system. It was a very small community, and so people would find that they were being dismissed from the hospital and going home. And they're 86 years old, and their 87-year-old husband was coming to pick them up in the pickup. And so they said, we've got to have a better transportation system for people that are leaving the hospital after, especially once we had DRGs and people are still leaving the hospital and they couldn't stand up. And they set up a whole network of volunteers to help transport frail, elderly, or any post-surgical patient home in a much safer manner. It's that kind of linkage that can really be helpful. I think the thing that's important about community mobilization is that it's truly, in its best forms, it leads to the kind of social cohesion that Representative Carlson was talking about, where people believe that they can make a difference. They believe we are all responsible for the well-being of families and community and children and youth in our communities, not just the government or the social worker or the school. And they have a way to exercise that belief. That is, there's a role that they can see that they can do, that they can pull off a piece of it that's small enough to feel some success at. And that might be volunteering or being a part of a SMART program. It's one of the, as you look at the movement towards thinking about community, I think it's interesting in the Oregon benchmarks that one of the benchmarks we have is that the percentage of Oregonians who volunteer 50 or more hours a year. That is very directly a statement about engagement in the community. So I'd be happy to answer questions and make comments. I think I would like to end by saying this is not the end-all and be-all of reducing all the problems we have, but it is certainly it's a piece of creating an environment for all children and families and youth. Thank you very much.
Questions? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, do you think that probably because of the history that Representative Carlson spoke of, you know, where over the last 20 years we've sort of abdicated our own responsibilities to the government, to the social worker, to the teacher, mm-hmm. to the whoever sort of somebody else was there. And now, you know, people are kind of saying, you know, they're tired of the social workers coming in and butting into their business and they want mm-hmm. to really mm-hmm. get out and that sort of thing. So do you think in that respect that we're seeing a shift in community attitudes where people are saying, you know, we're going to take back our community and we're going to take it back. You know, so some members of the community, they're saying, you know, we don't want the government doing this anymore. We want to do it ourselves and we're going to take it back. Do you kind of see that happening?
I think what I see more and what I hear more from people that are involved in these in community mobilization actions is they're saying not that we don't want the government to do this anymore, but that we don't want the government to do it alone. We realize that schools aren't the end. I mean, we don't all want to become, it's not like we want to take back the schools, but we want parent councils. So we can say, is this school feeding our kids what we want them to eat? Is this school opening at a time that makes sense for us? Is the school staying open or have some activity for the days on President's Day when I have no child care? I mean, are the high schools closing on the same days that the undergrad or the elementary schools closing so that my older kids can be home with my younger kids while I'm over taking care of my mother or working? I think people are moving to saying, what's an appropriate role for us? Not so much let's take government back in the sense of let's take over the social service system or the education system, but how can we be engaged in a way that makes that system more ours? And what are the things that we can do that it can't do? And there certainly are things that individuals can do that it can't do.
Any other questions? Thank you, Claire.
Thank you very much for your time.
We have folks from Harney and Wallowa County, Michael and Peg.
You want both of us?
Sure. You both came from a long way. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to represent Wallowa County. Left about 6 o'clock this morning. Got here in time for the hearing. When we talk about community mobilization...
Can you please state your name for the record?
Oh, yes. Sorry. Peg VanderZanden.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Community mobilization in Wallowa County has started to happen, is continuing to happen. I'd like to share one of our situations with you. About 5 years ago, there was a young woman who took over our domestic violence services, and she started with a bank account of $17 and passion. Today, that program is operating on $150,000 a year budget for Wallowa County. That's pretty good. She's been able to leverage $500,000 through the course of those 5 years. In the process, there's over 26,000 hours of volunteer time that have been clocked by the citizens of Wallowa County around domestic violence issues. We are starting to see an increase in the number of people asking for help because of the attention that's been drawn around domestic violence issues. That, to me, is community mobilization. That was someone with passion that through some assistance with commission dollars over the past 5 years has mobilized a group of people around a definite problem in our community. We are looking at some other problems in our community that need the same kind of effort and the same kind of mobilization: alcohol, tobacco, and drug issues, mental health issues. And we're starting to see passionate people begin to step up to the plate and make a difference in our county. That's what community mobilization is to us. It is community building. Oftentimes, in the absence of dollars or resources, one of our concerns when we look at the word development, oftentimes it's associated with economic development. And mobilization to us is, we're moving forward. We're moving people forward. And in our county anyway, the word mobilization is a better depiction of what's happening. Do you have any questions for me today?
So if we change this language, would that dramatically alter what you're doing?
No, it might just confuse people a little bit.
Okay, so you have a lot of people in Wallowa County that read the ORSs?
No. No, we don't.
Okay.
Any other just the lawyers?
Lawyers, okay. Well, hopefully they don't have too many of those out in real Oregon. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Sarine. I'm the director of the Harney County Commission on Children and Families from Burns. And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to speak on this issue. I am a great believer, and although I may not come across that way, passionate about this issue because I've been doing it for 30 years. I cut my teeth out of college in the early 70s in the War on Poverty, the old OEL CSA programs, and have been doing that pretty much all of my career. And with regard to the specifics of this, you know, to me it's kind of wordsmithing, and I think it would be more confusing than anything, because while our folks may not read the OARs, this has been being talked about for the last 6-7 years in every county in Oregon. We've talked about community mobilization. That's what we do. It's part of what we do. Personally, community development to me sounds more like something that is done to somebody. Community mobilization is about getting the people doing it themselves. And that's a big difference. And that's, but it's really a key part of what we're talking about here in the whole commission mission, is getting the community involved in solving its own problems. And in addition to some of the questions that Representative Kremel had brought forward in the discussion about it, another analogy I might make is, you know, you hear a lot about local control from AOC and from the counties, and we're always telling the counties, we're always telling the state we want local control. You take that one more step forward, community mobilization is about neighborhoods and towns saying to the county and to the state, local control. We want to be involved in the decision-making about these programs and how they work and what we do. So I think it's very important that that the State Commission and our legislators and city and county governments understand the concept of community development or community mobilization, whatever you want to call it, and understand that that is the work that we do. You know, we don't just funnel money through for programs. That's the least of what we do. And whatever we can do to reinforce that, I think is good. I'm just not sure that this is it.
Would either of you like to comment on the inclusion of economic opportunity and social cohesion on page one of the bill? Does that give you heartburn?
Well, it doesn't bother me. That's essentially the opening comment in our phase one community mapping document. Mm-hmm. I'd actually, my opening line was going to be, it's the economy, stupid. Mm-hmm. As we've all heard that. My chair suggested I edit that down a little bit, so I did make a little
bit. And you did, so.
But it is. I mean, that's the underpinning you know, some large percent of our problem, 80-90%. Certainly is in Harney County, where our economic problem there continues to worsen. If you look at the charts, you know, our average annual income and per capita income, all those indicators are steadily dropping. And the bottom line is, if people can't get their basic needs met, then it just rolls over and over and over.
Willow County would echo that. We have the highest unemployment rate in the state right now, with our mills closing 10.7%. In fact, with our citizen survey results, the number one concern for them was the lack of family wage jobs.
And we got mills in Douglas County too.
Yeah,
not as many as we used to.
Right,
Representative Lee.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. In most outside of the legislative session, most of the people I work with are in Eastern Oregon, so I really appreciate your comments. To me, community development means infrastructure and building, and I agree with your point that it could be confusing. So I can support the bill, but I'm not sure that I can support changing the word development, because if it means something to people in communities, then I'd rather leave it alone.
Representative Gerard.
I'm curious as to both of your opinions on the definition of basic needs, and whether that is becoming a couple of nouns rather than adjectives, showing some action and speaking of mobilization. Are basic needs changing rapidly?
If I could comment on that, Representative Girard?
Yes.
We just had a meeting yesterday from our Family Issues Committee. 20 citizens, service providers that come together, and the topic was self-sufficiency, allowing people to take care of their own needs and enabling them as well as empowering them to get to that point. In Wallowa County today, there are several names on a waiting list for assistance with electrical needs, electricity, heating their homes, children are cold. Our food banks, we did just receive some help with our food banks, and the people that received help 3 months ago are reluctant to come back to get it again, but are needing it again. Our banks are depleted. Basic needs in Wallowa County are basic needs, food, shelter, housing, affordable housing, transportation. And those are issues that group of people in that committee are striving to build some strategies around to increase the potential for a family to be self-sufficient.
Thank you. And I'd add, from Harney County perspective, just to give you some perspective, our mill closed in 1980. We lost 1,300 people at 35% unemployment rate for some time. And it's been a struggle since then. And it was in 95 or so when the last piece of that mill, the last vestige of the rolling over of the mill, was closed, and they tore it down and shipped it to Russia or wherever. And since then, we've had kind of I was going to say blessing in disguise. I don't know if that's the right wording. We reported in September of 98 that we had replaced all of the jobs that we had lost since 1980. September of 98, we had more jobs in Harney County than in recorded history. The reality of that, I mean, that sounds great, but the reality is that we replaced 1,300 $12 to $20 an hour mill jobs with basically minimum wage to $11 an hour jobs, if you will. Those are poverty level jobs. Those are not family wage jobs. And the poverty level in Harney County has risen. And I think in Oregon, the stats are, you know, we have more children living in poverty than in any time in history.
I think we're seeing that kind of across the face of rural Oregon, that we're losing family wage jobs or industry jobs, and they're being replaced by service jobs. And,
yes.
And that's kind of the dynamic we're all dealing with. So, any other questions? Thank you very much. Donna, did you want to say anything about this? Or? Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Donna Middleton. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. Representative Cruz, members of the committee. The Commission on Children and Families has been working with Dr. Clara Pratt and local commissions to begin to develop a definition, if you will, of community mobilization or community development. I think the word mobilization for some folks means lining up folks and having them march down a certain path, and I think the reason that they're confused about that might be the fact that we have not defined it well. We have not articulated the vision around community mobilization, and so when you talk about it, it conjures up all sorts of images for folks. And so I think Representative Carlson's bill sort of draws the attention to a piece of the work that local commissions are about, which is bringing communities to bear on the issues of children and families in their communities. That's part of their role and function. So as far as what we call it, I think the issue is not what we call it, but how we define it. And we need to define it, because I've gotten many questions from policymakers, from other agency folks about, you know, what does that mean? What does community mobilization mean? What do they do? Do they go around and just talk to families, or do they, you know, so what we're trying to do now is define it. Development is one way you can define it. It develops communities. It develops supports for communities. The commission has no position on the title. I will also add, however, that the commission would support looking at it in a broader base through economic and social issues and the coordination of those things. I mean, that is what we're trying to do. As you heard from the two Eastern Oregon folks, their issue is really economic and probably less social than economic at this particular time. All of those things make up a community. So, we support what this committee would like to do around the definition and around the name.
Okay. I guess, Donna, I mean, all we're doing is changing the word. The definition stays the same in statute here. And I guess my concern is if the local folks are starting to identify with one, and it's at our level that we're having trouble with the definition, we should probably be the ones that change and not them. So, okay. Any questions? Representative Cromwell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Donna, do you think you made a comment that, for example, in Eastern Oregon, in Harney County and that sort of thing, it's less social and more economic, but don't economic problems lead to a greater reliance on the social system?
Representative Crummell, absolutely. I would suggest that it goes back to the basic needs questions of Representative Cruz, which are you going to support first, the basic needs or what happens after the basic needs? We would suggest that you try to support the basic needs to eliminate or alleviate those future problems.
Representative Barnhart.
I'm wondering if, in your view, the statute might not be permissive in that we refer to community mobilization or community development and community development, so that those who want to use one term can use that, and those who want to use the other term could use that. The point, of course, is what does it mean in the community, and will people understand correctly what we're up to?
Right. Chair Cruz, Representative Barnhart, certainly. I think it is most important how it translates to the community. And what the community needs to be able to do is articulate it both in what the vision is for community mobilization and, secondly, what the outcomes they're hoping to achieve. And that's where you have Claire Pratt and her work to support that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Donna. Committee, Representative Barnhart has had a good idea of making it, I was inclined up to this point to just say we'll go back to mobilization, and because it appears so many places in the bill, I wasn't going to try to do this conceptually. So it'd be my intention to not go into work session on this and draft an amendment. So, Representative Lee. Then Representative Moss.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe that if you use and, it sounds like two different things.
Yeah.
And I think you really need to have just one.
Okay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would tend to agree. Community mobilization was very foreign to me about 5 or 6 years ago in my profession, but I've gotten so used to it in my community also, the people that I'm working with. That's the term we're starting to use now.
Representative Comer?
Yes, having recently come from city government and where community development was very clearly defined as a physical kind of development in the city infrastructure, that to me I think it would be confusing to change that.
Okay, so my sense of the committee is we like mobilization. So we will draft an amendment to eliminate development and reinstate mobilization, and we'll bring the bill back.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cromwell,
I just want to toss something up.
You always try to confuse simple things. Go ahead.
I know, but what if you changed the word increase? Took it out on line 17 and put in the word develop so that it would read community mobilization means government and private efforts to develop
community awareness and facilitate the active participation of citizens and organizations in projects and issues that will have positive impact on the well-being of children, families, and communities. I think, and what made me think about that was when Donna was talking about, you know, using the term develop in the definition. I'm just wondering.
Well, Representative Cromwell, I understand that, but that's basically creating an assumption that none exists, and community awareness does exist. We're just trying to increase it. We don't want to insult people here.
Okay. Thank you.
So, any other comments? Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on 2490, and we will have it back. And we will open a public hearing on 2643. Diane.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, House Bill 2643 directs the Oregon Progress Board to consult with the Oregon State University when conducting reviews of outcomes achieved by local coordinated comprehensive plans developed by the local commissions on children and families. The local comprehensive coordinated comprehensive plans are part of the Senate Bill 555 that was passed last session, which you do have a copy of.
Representative Carlson. I don't know why you go clear to the back and you go walk clear the way back. Oh.
2643.
Excuse me. Yeah. So rarely get sitting back.
Thank you, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. First of all, I need to let you know that this bill was not brought to me at the request of Oregon State University, nor was it brought to me at the request of the Progress Board. This is something I came up with entirely on my own to raise an issue that I'd like to share with you, and then perhaps those entities there are, I think they're available to answer questions, and there's some other people signed up to testify as well. And I want to tell you a little bit about how benchmarks and outcomes fit in with the work of commissions on children and families in Senate Bill 555. As some of you know, I was actually an employee of the State Commission on Children and Families way back when, and started in 91 and ended in late 95. And prior to the 93 legislative session, when we became the Commission on Children and Families, we had another name and sort of a smaller mandate. Prior to that, the Oregon Progress Board was working on benchmarks, and the commission was actually one of the leaders in taking the Oregon benchmarks and moving the data to the county level. And I actually went out and did presentations on benchmarks to local commissions around the state, particularly in Southern Oregon, talked about what the concept meant, how benchmarks might fit into the work on children and families. And as we actually started then trying to take that work and apply it at the local level, we ran into a couple shortcomings. The first shortcoming is that benchmarks are very global. So if you're measuring teen pregnancy rates or juvenile crime rates or school dropout rates, that may apply to a county. You may even be able to apply it to a city. But if you're talking about a program, and oftentimes the way that we're moving change with people is through individual programs, either working separately or working together, it becomes very difficult, for example, for a teen parent program to measure their success by teen pregnancy rates, because people come in and out, you know, and change varies over time. The second problem that we ran into with the benchmarks, particularly in the area of youth, in the area of young children, the benchmarks are fairly positive. How many children are immunized? Are children ready for school? When you get into youth, it is around dropout rates, pregnancy, substance abuse, juvenile crime. And I went, I think it was in 92, to a national conference for the Center of Youth Development and Policy Research, and I talked with a woman there, Bonnie Politz, who I just saw, by the way, at a National Conference of State Legislatures conference. And I was explaining to her benchmarks, and I was very excited, and I had all these graphs and charts and was showing her what benchmarks were about. And she said, "Janet, do you have children?" And I said, "Yes, I have three." And she said, "If your daughter became an adult and you could say about her, she didn't get pregnant, she didn't drop out of school, she didn't get arrested by the juvenile department, and she didn't use alcohol and drugs, do you feel like you would be a success as a parent?" I said, "Absolutely not. I want my daughter to have good friends. I want her to enjoy art and music and literature. I want her to have a job that she really enjoys. I want her to find a mate and have children and have a good family. I mean, these are my hopes and my desires for my daughter." And the comment that Bonnie made was, "Well, maybe then you need to do something about your benchmarks."
So one of the issues that we have around this is that we need to find some ways to measure positive things. And in defense of the benchmarks, because we are looked at in Oregon as a leader in this regard, we measure oftentimes the things that we collect. But what I would like to present to you is that until we start collecting positive things, we're never going to measure them. And we have this sort of chicken and egg thing going on where we don't collect positive things, so we don't use them as a benchmark, so we don't have them, so, you know, and it goes on and on. So one of the things that we've been working on, and I'll tell you one other story that sort of affected me. When I went to work as an interim director in Lane County for the Commission on Children and Families and was very interested in family resource centers, and they had divided the county into 10 regions, each region developing its own family resource centers. So we had a meeting with all the coordinators together, and I said, well, let's figure out how we can get a common outcome and measure the success of all these family resource centers. So I said, what do you want to do? Do you want to reduce juvenile crime? Do you want to increase readiness for school? I gave them all of these big goals, and they couldn't go there. They could not fathom how they could get from what they were doing to that level. So I said, okay, tell you what, I'll meet with each of you individually, and I'll interview you, and then we'll come back together at the next meeting. So when I sat down with them, I flipped the paradigm, and instead of saying, what high-level goal is it that you want to accomplish, I said, what do you do every day? And they'd say, well, you know, we have a parenting group for moms and their young babies, and we have the moms, and they sing to their babies, and they read stories. Well, why do you do that? Well, we do that because we want them to network, and we want them to build good relationships with each other, and together they learn better parenting skills. And I kept taking them up the ladder. So, you know, then what happens? And by the time we got done, they all know intrinsically why they're doing these things if they're good practitioners. They don't do it from a research perspective or a theory perspective. They do it from a day-to-day perspective. And so it became much easier for people to start with what they did and talk about why they did it than start with this global outcome and work down to then how does this relate to what you do. So I was going to say great minds think alike, because at the time I was having all these experiences, the State Commission on Children and Families was contracting again with Dr. Clara Pratt from Oregon State University. And she developed, in conjunction with a number of other people, I always call it the Clara Pratt books, but Clara would probably tell you there were a number of other people involved, this Building Results Framework. And this is the book that has a ton of research. This is the best book you'll ever have for writing grants. There are two companion books. This one actually has then how you measure it, different tools. In the area of youth, in the area of young children, the benchmarks are fairly positive. How many children are immunized? Are children ready for school? When you get into youth, it is around dropout rates, pregnancy, substance abuse, juvenile crime. And I went, I think it was in 92, to a national conference for the Center of Youth Development and Policy Research, and I talked with a woman there, Bonnie Politz, who I just saw, by the way, at a National Conference of State Legislatures conference. And I was explaining to her benchmarks, and I was very excited, and I had all these graphs and charts and was showing her what benchmarks were about. And she said, Janet, do you have children? And I said, yes, I have three. And she said, if your daughter became an adult and you could say about her, she didn't get pregnant, she didn't drop out of school, she didn't get arrested by the juvenile department, and she didn't use alcohol and drugs, do you feel like you would be a success as a parent? I said, absolutely not. I want my daughter to have good friends. I want her to enjoy art and music and literature. I want her to have a job that she really enjoys. I want her to find a mate and have children and have a good family. I mean, these are my hopes and my desires for my daughter. And the comment that Bonnie made was, well, maybe then you need to do something about your benchmarks. So one of the issues that we have around this is that we need to find some ways to measure positive things. And in defense of the benchmarks, because we are looked at in Oregon as a leader in this regard, we measure oftentimes the things that we collect. But what I would like to present to you is that until we start collecting positive things, we're never going to measure them. And we have this sort of chicken and egg thing going on where we don't collect positive things, so we don't use them as a benchmark, so we don't have them, so, you know, and it goes on and on. So one of the things that we've been working on, and I'll tell you one other story that sort of affected me. When I went to work as an interim director in Lane County for the Commission on Children and Families and was very interested in family resource centers, and they had divided the county into 10 regions, each region developing its own family resource centers. So we had a meeting with all the coordinators together, and I said, well, let's figure out how we can get a common outcome and measure the success of all these family resource centers. So I said, what do you want to do? Do you want to reduce juvenile crime? Do you want to increase readiness for school? I gave them all of these big goals, and they couldn't go there. They could not fathom how they could get from what they were doing to that level. So I said, okay, tell you what, I'll meet with each of you individually, and I'll interview you, and then we'll come back together at the next meeting. So when I sat down with him, I flipped the paradigm. And instead of saying, what high-level goal is it that you want to accomplish, I said, what do you do every day? And they'd say, well, you know, we have a parenting group for moms and their young babies. And we have the moms, and they sing to their babies, and they read stories. Well, why do you do that? Well, we do that because we want them to network, and we want them to build good relationships with each other. And together, they learn better parenting skills. And I kept taking them up the ladder. So, you know, then what happens? Then what happens? And by the time we got done, they all know intrinsically why they're doing these things if they're good practitioners. They don't do it from a research perspective or a theory perspective. They do it from a day-to-day perspective. And so it became much easier for people to start with what they did and talk about why they did it than start with this global outcome and work down to then how does this relate to what you do. So I was going to say great minds think alike, because at the time I was having all these experiences, the State Commission on Children and Families was contracting again with Dr. Clara Pratt from Oregon State University. And she developed, in conjunction with a number of other people, I always call it the Clara Pratt books, but Clara would probably tell you there were a number of other people involved, this building results framework. And this is the book that has a ton of research. This is the best book you'll ever have for writing grants. There are two companion books. This one actually has then how you measure it, different tools, these two books together. They have an appendix of measures and different instruments and tools that you can use either in the book, or you could, it has the addresses and emails that you can send away for them if they're proprietary. The State Commission on Children and Families developed a database with these measures that they developed in here, and they each have a number. And local commissions on children and families, when they contract with their providers, ask their providers to actually select from this menu of outcomes, and it goes on the internet. And we measure success of programs that local commissions fund through this building results framework. One of the things that was done with this is that this measuring program outcomes that United Way has put out, it's a national book, that these concepts were incorporated into this. So when I work with providers, because most of you, if you've worked in communities, know that your nonprofits get money from lots of different sources. They weave all kinds of money together. So if they get money from a local commission, a number of times they'll also get money from United Way. And if they're measuring the United Way framework, they can also use building results because they're interchangeable. There's a packet. Have you handed out the packet that you have in front of you? Let me give you, in the paper, and this is just gives you sort of a definition. I wrote this for Marion County about what benchmarks are, and then the different community and participant outcomes. But as an example, if you were looking at, let me see if I can find it in here. Well, if you were looking at trying to, for example, increase the ability of a child to be ready for school, okay? One of the things that you know for children to be ready for school is that they need to have a strong sense of self, and they need to be able to develop healthy emotionally and socially. An interim measure of that is the quality of the child's interactions with his or her parents. And so then when you go down, well, how do you measure the quality of interactions with parents? Well, you could use a global assessment of functioning scale. I mean, these are some of the tools that are in here, and actually measure the children's improved functioning with that particular measure. So what we're trying to do is develop this logic model. Here's the benchmark. Here's the interim indicator that gets there. And here's the way that you measure it. Another issue that comes up with outcomes, too, is that what we found is that when you get down to this, like, for example, with teen pregnancy and school dropout and so on, a lot of it is whether the child is involved in constructive activities between 4 and 8 p.m. I'm sure you've heard that research. So if you're dealing with that particular measure, you're addressing several benchmarks all at once. So the benchmarks intertwine and interweave and can't necessarily be separated out individually. I gave you some copies of some of the funding applications so that you can get a sense of how this applies at the local level. The Commissions on Children and Families get flexible money, and it's in the scope of state budgets, it's not very large. I've got a spreadsheet on the back where you can see what your counties are getting right now. Marion County actually gets about $3 million of flexible money during a two-year period that they use for community mobilization, for planning activities, and for programs. So not all of it goes out for programs, but some goes out by request for proposal. We've been working for the last 3 years with our partners and have actually developed a common request for proposal format so that people that apply to United Way, the City of Salem, Marion County, Children and Families, and the Community Action Agency for money use exactly the same form. They don't have to write four different grant requests.
they can use the same narrative and then just plug in what specifics they have for the different program. We're using the building results framework, and we have all these four entities have been willing to adopt this logic model format that I talked to you about earlier and the numbered measures that are on the internet as our system. And I won't go through the supplemental one because I feel like I'm going on here forever, but I just want to explain this to you. If you turn to this one with the sample outcomes that has kind of the pretty flowers on the corner, let me just give you an example there so that this is a little bit more real to you. In the first page, it has the HOST program, which is the Northwest Human Services Agency. This is a shelter for teens, all right? Their database outcome, which is an interim outcome, all right, so this isn't even a benchmark level, this is a lower level, is educational commitments and aspirations and stable supportive living situations. So that's what we would put on the internet. The way that we measure the educational commitment and aspirations is that the HOST program says we connect every youth that comes into our program back with school, either with an alternative program, with their school, you know, or with some sort of a GED program. So what we do is we measure the number of youth in shelter that are there more than 3 days, because we figure if they're there shorter than 3 days, the program probably doesn't impact them that much. And then we find out how many at intake are enrolled in school, have dropped out, or have sporadic attendance. And then at 3 months after discharge from the shelter, we check to make sure that they're still enrolled in school and hopefully haven't dropped out or have sporadic attendance. So then we're able to say, you know, 95% of the youth that are have been involved in the whole shelter are reconnected with school. We know if kids are connected with school, they're bound to be less likely to drop out, to be involved with crime, to be involved in other risky behavior. So that's one example. The next program, the Hubbard After School program, a little bit of a different program, that outcome is participation in positive school, neighborhood, or community activities by youth. And what we do is, for the first indicator at the bottom, we look at just the number of youth who actually participate in this after-school program 3 or more times a week. Research tells us that if a child is involved in an after-school program at least 3 times a week, they're going to have the influence of those positive activities, that constructive use of time, is going to be helpful to them, and then therefore they're going to be less likely to be involved in risky behavior, more likely to be involved in good behavior. So anyway, that's the gist of how we use outcomes at the local level. And so one of the concerns that I've had about the evaluation of Senate Bill 555 is that the Progress Board is responsible for evaluating it, and up until very recently was not really building that evaluation on this entire system that we've been working so hard at the local level to explain to people, to get our partners to buy into, and so forth. There has been some movement, and actually the Oregon State University and Dr. Claire Pratt is now involved with the group that's been developing the evaluation. So it's possible that we may not need to make this change, and we can simply just get their commitment that they'll continue to work together. But I think it's really important as we do evaluation work that we build on this great, this is a great system. United Way was so excited when they saw it because they were going to spend a whole lot of money and create their own system. They said, we'll just use yours. The work's already done. So it allows us to be able to say, program by program, we may not be able to globally change those juvenile crime rates, but we can show these research-based outcomes that, taken all together, will ultimately result in us addressing the benchmark with all our programs working in tandem. I know that was a lot of information. Hopefully that made sense.
Alternatively,
Are there other potential groups or universities that might also be included, or is this so specific that having Oregon State University would kind of cover the range of folks who need to work with the Progress Board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, that's a good question. I mean, I work as an adjunct with the University of Oregon, and I know Dr. Hill Walker's been involved in some of the other areas that we've been working on, juvenile crime prevention, multisystemic therapy, that type of thing. But I think, actually, Oregon State University has been uniquely involved in taking a look globally at what all of these interim measures are. Dr. Pratt has done trainings around the state and at the state level to help us kind of learn how to use the system. The outcomes in this system that Oregon State has put out are on this internet database. So in that sense, it is rather unique. It's not that there aren't people else in the state that work on outcomes, but I think we've sort of embraced the system and started using it.
Yeah, this sounds like by far the key player then.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Representative Morris Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the same concern. I have actually trained with Carol before. I mean, she's given a training that I've been involved with, and very much I'm very involved, or had been very involved with the work and that she has done. But if Carol got a better job at OHSU, her research would probably follow her. And so I like the idea of, you know, I'm not quite sure how the wording is. I think it's important to have one entity at this point in time so that it's apples and apples up when we're measuring outcomes. But I do have, I would somehow like to word it or see the wording, and I'm not sure if you've given that much thought regarding how we could word it so that we wouldn't run into complications, because this pretty much narrows the field to Oregon State University.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond just briefly to that. I would, two things. One is that when Oregon State University came to me, a little bit concerned that they saw their name on a bill that they had nothing to do with. And what I talked with them about, and this might solve the problem that you're addressing, is that we've tried really hard this last 10 years, at least the time that I've been involved with this body as a committee administrator and now, to link our public policy decisions with the learnings that we get from higher education. There has been such a disconnect. I mean, we have these wonderful research bodies in our state, and then we sit in this building and, you know, sort of make things up as we go along without looking at what the studies are. And now we've had Dr. Hill Walker before us, and for the last three sessions, Dr. Pratt has been with us as well to help inform our decision-making, and I think that's wonderful. So maybe in consultation with higher education, you know, or something to that effect that makes it a little bit more global, might address that, and then it would be inclusive of all of our institutions rather than just noting Oregon State.
Before we get too deep for the committee, the reason for hearing this bill is because I think this sort of collaboration is necessary, and what I'm hoping is that when we have Jeff and Clara back up here, we'll find out that indeed it is happening on its own, and this legislation will be unnecessary. But it's certainly important for us to have the discussion to make sure that the collaboration is there. And so that, and if indeed, and I have a feeling we're going to hear that from them, we'll close this public hearing and the bill will go nowhere. So, any questions at this point?
Again, my feelings will not be heard.
Well, and that's not necessarily the relevant factor here.
But you could phrase it a bit more delicately.
Behind
it.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I guess it's in response to both of these recent comments. I mean, if it turned out that the bill were necessary, would it be possible to put in more inclusive language, for example, in consultation with the Oregon University system?
Yeah, something. I'm absolutely
something open. Like that. But again, if it's already being dealt with, then we don't need to do it.
Representative, that would be fine too. What we're hoping is that we're seeing a very inclusive process here, and that folks like Hill Walker are also being consulted on these various issues. Because, and Representative Carlson's right, we have some of the best minds in the field in the state of Oregon, and for a long time we ignored them. And I'm glad we, you know, like Hill Walker and Clara Pratt, and I'm glad we are no longer ignoring them, and we're using them as the resource that they should be used as. So,
and Mr. Chair, if I could just add one more thing in sort of response, playing the devil's advocate to that line of reasoning, if Mr. Tryans were to also find a better job elsewhere 5 years and go away, you know, would the Progress Board remember that they're supposed to collaborate with higher education, you know? So the legislative direction right now simply lists the Progress Board, so it might be just something to consider about whether we want to make that clear in statute.
It could be, but okay. Any other questions?
We might note, Mr. Chair, that the old rule is that an expert is someone with a briefcase who's more than 100 miles from home.
I have a briefcase. Okay, cool. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you.
Jeff, you and Claire want to come together on this? My first question for you, Jeff, is have you been offered a job by Mexico? Or? I know you're quite popular down there. So.
Mr. Chair, for the record, My name is Jeff Tryant. I'm executive director of the Oregon Progress Board, and no, I haven't been offered a job by Mexico yet.
Yeah. I'm Claire Pratt from Oregon State University.
The first thing I need to say, Ms. Chair, is that the Progress Board has not met since I became aware of this board. So the Progress Board has not taken a position either way on the bill. This is I'm speaking just for myself as executive director appearing here this afternoon. I think it's fair to say that that the Progress Board for a number of years has consulted with Claire Pratt and her colleagues at Oregon State University. Claire and I haven't always agreed on everything that we have been involved in. I used to characterize some of her measures as fuzzy measures because I didn't see how we could possibly measure some of the things that were at those levels that the representative was speaking about. And I would also say that everything that the representative said about needing a set of measures that go from the program up and the problems that we have with measuring a lot of negative things about youth, those are all things that I'm and the Progress Board are very aware of. And I spent as much time in the last 2 years on Senate Bill 555 implementation and trying to develop a tiered set of measures that people actually feel like they have some influence over, because the worst thing that can happen, and Representative Carlson is right, in the early days we all said, well, okay, here are the benchmarks, you go out and you repair them, you fix them. So local commissions on children and families would have as their measure of success the poverty rate within the county. Just not a feasible way to do business. So we are very aware of those problems, and I have spent a great deal of time working on them with Claire and others. The other thing I would say from the institutional point of view is that the governor has appointed me to be on the steering committee as a representative from the Progress Board for Senate Bill 555 at the state agency level, which has now expanded out, so it has representatives from local partners. Chaired by Donna Middleton, and so I am institutionally quite involved in the implementation of Senate Bill 555. The other thing I would mention is you'll notice in the language that exists now that it says that the Progress Board must coordinate its review with evaluations conducted according to subsection 1 of this section. There are many evaluations that are occurring as part of the Senate Bill 555 ongoing process. What one of the things we're trying to do is get the evaluations more coordinated, so you don't have the Office of Drug and Alcohol in 1 month and you have the commission in the next month and you have somebody else doing the early childhood piece last year. I mean, it's kind of like when they repave your highway and then they come in and they run the fiber cable the next month and you go, well, that was the stupidest thing I ever saw. So we're trying to coordinate those things so at the local level it actually looks like we're coordinated at the state level. That's sort of one of the ideas behind this. So I would say that I personally have no objection to having this language because it's something we already do, and quite frankly it's not like there's a lot of money involved. After this year, I am expected to take this out of my existing appropriation, so I don't have a lot of money that I will either share or not share with Oregon State because there's no money there to share. But as I said, I have no expectation that the board would have an objection to this language, but it is also something that I think we would agree we're doing an awful lot of now as it currently stands.
I concur with that. I think over the years, one of the things that I think is real evidence of that is in the last year, Jeff, representing the Progress Board, and I and Lenny Bjornson from the Department of Human Resources all kind of got together and said, can we agree on a language? And that may seem like a small thing, but it isn't. And so we're all now using the same terms to say that to mean the same thing. And I think that's a real breakthrough. Certainly we've gotten more and more sophisticated in the whole idea of what do we need to track and what's appropriate and what do you hold programs accountable for. And I think both the Progress Board has made some movements towards understanding the idea of program level accountability, not being the same as county and state level accountability, but also we've made some movements in terms of understanding the what they're trying to do, not just with human services, but and with children and youth, but the whole issue of natural resources and the other areas that the Progress Board works in. So I would say I think we have made some progress. I think it is always, and you're certainly right about not having a lot of money to share. It's important to note that we got involved, the colleagues that I have at OSU and myself got involved with this, as part of our research that we're doing anyway. And so it isn't dependent on somebody giving us $35,000 or $45,000 or $50,000. We have, when we've taken on major contracts from the commission, say $25,000 to put these books together, all my colleagues around the country told me I was nuts. But it was a huge issue in Oregon, and it seemed relevant to address it. And I think that's part of what universities, especially land-grant universities, ought to be doing. I would also say that the Building Results book that is the framework for much of what the commissions, and I've been quite gratified that other agencies as well have taken it on, the Urban League in Portland, the United Way, and Columbia Willamette just talked with me about doing some training for them. I just came back from United Way training in Lane County not long ago. People are really finding this work very helpful, and it's always evolving. We did not do all this research. We did the library research that pulled together the research, and Hill Walker and his work and other work that from around the country is cited in that. So it's a much more collaborative process. And if something comes up that I don't have the answer to, and that happens frequently, I consider it my job to figure out which of my university colleagues, sometimes in Wisconsin, sometimes in Virginia, sometimes at the U of O, might have a better answer than I have, because the commission is, and the communities are working in very complicated areas, and some of which are quite unique. How you reduce teen pregnancy among methamphetamine-dependent rural young women. I mean, that's not something that's sort of common knowledge. And so sometimes you have to really look around at what are some successful models. So I just reviewed the planning guidelines for the local plans, for the second phase of the local plans, and I was really quite gratified to see that the relationship between the benchmarks and the high-level outcomes and the building results work that so many of the local commissions have been relying on is much clearer in the current draft. So I think we've made some, and we've learned to get along most of the time.
If I might make one other comment, Mr. Chair, the other thing that's important to note in here is that the language currently says that the Progress Board will identify successes in achieving targets specified in local plans. So we are putting the little money that we have that the legislature appropriated during this biennium, we're putting that into helping local groups identify reasonable targets and have reasonable measures, because if you don't have reasonable measures with reasonable targets, then the evaluation is meaningless. So our effort has been on the front end to help to put together a way that groups can learn. This is all about learning what worked and what didn't work. And so helping local groups develop a measurement framework that they can learn from and adjust their activities is really the ultimate value of this work. So we're doing a lot more on helping them develop those targets than just kind of sitting back and waiting until they fail and then going, aha, you didn't achieve the targets that you didn't know how to lay out for yourself in the first place.
Questions? Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say that I am extremely gratified with the work of the Progress Board, and also with the work at Oregon State University. And as a confirmed duck, I am extremely pleased to hear that you're making use of work at the University of Oregon as well.
I actually finished my degree, my doctoral degree at the University of Oregon.
Oh, you see that? So
I always win in football. I never lose at football.
I don't know, sometimes the games have been damn ugly on both sides.
Yeah, very true.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Cummins. Before I call Mike up, I'd like for him to respond. You can come on up, Mike, if you want. Committee,
I've had a slight change of heart, and I want to run something by you. If you look at line 23 of the bill, where it says, in consultation with Oregon State University, or following on what Representative Barnhart said, how about if we make it in consultation with the State of Oregon University System? Because maybe we do need to have this in statute. They're already doing it now, but this would be a clear signal to future legislatures that this was intent. So if there's no real heartburn with that, it's more inclusive, and we will attempt to draft an amendment to speak to that.
If I could ask a question about that, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess my only question would be, when it says Oregon State University, I know what it means. It means Clara Pratt and and her center. When it says the Oregon University System, I don't know what I do. Do I call Chancellor Cox and say, who should I work with on this? Do I go to each individual university? And it becomes and if somebody's not agreeing with me,
how about appropriate resources in the Oregon University System? Then it's discretionary.
That would be fine, Mr. Chair.
That, I mean, I don't want you working with the whole system, but I want you to work with the appropriate people in the system. So that would mean you could go to Clara, you could go to Hill. That work?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm just curious about something, though, and that is, and maybe it's not appropriate for us to statutorily declare one university over another, but as a lead university in that respect. But as we heard from Dr. Pratt, I mean, she can call the folks at U of O if she has a question. She can call if there's something going on. Maybe there's some research that's been going on out at Eastern Oregon. She can call out there, and she also has the flexibility of calling, you know, Wisconsin or Alabama or wherever. And what I'm wondering is it better to have one university as the lead university statutorily and let, but if you want to give, do you give the flexibility to the Progress Board and Jeff, or do we give the flexibility to Dr. Pratt?
Well, I'm going to assume that probably 20 years from now, Dr. Pratt may decide to retire. So we need to do things that are longitudinal here.
Well, it'll be 30 at least.
Okay, maybe 30 years she'll retire. I don't know. But if she's smart, he'll be before 30, yeah. I think. Mike, go ahead.
Thank you again.
I want to say that I am extremely gratified with the work of the Progress Board, and also with the work at Oregon State University, and as a confirmed duck, I am extremely pleased to hear that you're making use of work at the University of Oregon as well.
I actually finished my degree, my doctoral degree at the University of Oregon.
Oh, you see that?
Well, see, I always win in football. I never lose at football.
I don't know, sometimes the games have been damn ugly on both sides.
Yes, very true.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Colin. Before I call Mike up, I'd like for him to respond. You can come on up, Mike, if you want. Committee, I've had a slight change of heart, and I want to run something by you. If you look at line 23 of the bill, where it says, in consultation with Oregon State University, or following on what Representative Barnhart said, how about if we make it in consultation with the State of Oregon University System? Because maybe we do need to have this in statute. They're already doing it now, but this would be a clear signal to future legislatures that this was intent. So if there's no real heartburn with that, it's more inclusive, and we will
we will attempt to draft an amendment to speak to that.
If I could ask a question about that, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Jeff.
I guess my only question would be, when it says Oregon State University, I know what it means. It means Clara Pratt and the
right.
and her center. When it says the Oregon University System, I don't know what I do. Do I call Chancellor Cox and say, who should I work with on this? Do I go to each individual university? And it becomes more of a, and if somebody's not agreeing with me, if...
How about appropriate resources in the Oregon University System? Then it's discretionary.
That would be fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I don't want you working with the whole system, but I want you to work with the appropriate people in the system. So that would mean you could go to Clara, you could go to Hill. That work?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm just curious about something, though, and that is, and maybe it's not appropriate for us to statutorily declare one university over another, but as a lead university in that respect. But as we heard from Dr. Pratt, I mean, she can call the folks at U of O if she has a question. She can call if there's something going on. Maybe there's some research that's been going on out at Eastern Oregon. She can call out there, and she also has the flexibility of calling, you know, Wisconsin or Alabama or wherever. And what I'm wondering is it better to have one university as the lead university statutorily and let if you want to give, do you give the flexibility to the Progress Board and Jeff, or do we give the flexibility to Dr. Pratt?
Well, I'm going to assume that probably 20 years from now, Dr. Pratt may decide to retire. So we need to do things that are longitudinal here.
That would be 30 at least.
Okay, maybe 30 years she'll retire. I don't know. But if she's smart, he'll be before 30.
Yeah.
Mike, go ahead.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Sarine, Director of the Harney County Commission on Children and Families from Burns. And before I made my comments, a disclaimer that I should have made the first time, and please add that if you can, is that the comments I'm making are my comments. They're not the official position of our commission or our county court, as that, you know, we've not deliberated on these issues, but I think they would probably agree with me, and I'm trying to reflect what I think their perspective is. I'd like to just comment briefly on two things with regard to this bill, without really having an opinion about if the Progress Board and OSU are or are not working together at an appropriate level. I really don't know. But I want to reinforce two things. One is the importance of the work that Clara Pratt has done, and as Janet mentioned, you know, the best practices stuff. And it's important because, while I think we may not want to admit it, the reality is that prior to that time, in most of the counties, we were shooting in the dark. We didn't know what we were doing. And we were all doing good things. You know, we were out there putting those fence posts in the ground and doing good things. But we were doing it intuitively. And as H.L. Mencken once said, for every problem, there is a solution that is quick, simple, and wrong. And I think that's part of what we've dealt with over the years, is too often we make, we solve problems without research, without knowledge and understanding. And what Claire has done is given us a very simple, but very effective tool. She's given us a blueprint and power tools, if you will, and rulers to measure our progress. And most commissions have built that into their RFP process, their evaluation processes. They require that what the providers do be research-based, and that they demonstrate that. So, you know, I think that's a big part of the change and the success that we've seen in the last several years since that's come forward. The second thing I'd speak to that's maybe not even germane, but I'm going to take this opportunity to throw it out, and that's on the progress board side, and it has to do with data collection. And one of the problems that local commissions always have is that creating new data and data collection systems and systems to evaluate that is very time-consuming, and it's expensive. And most of the small rural counties, which is most of the counties in Oregon, don't have the staff or expertise to do that well. And if my county judge was sitting here, he would probably tell you about one of his common gripes, and I think we've all experienced it in the rural areas, is that the state collects a ton of data. Every state agency collects tons and tons of data that's never utilized. And if you ask them for it, I tell you, well, you know, we've got it, but it's not accumulated, it's not computerized, it's not usable. And if one of the things that could be really beneficial in all of these efforts is if the progress board could not only better identify what those data points are, what those measurements are, but find out where that existing data already exists and is already being collected, and facilitate means to make that data useful, that would be powerful.
Yes, Jeff, come on up.
I never want to miss an opportunity to show how we're helping out rural counties. At the request of the Association of Oregon Counties, actually, the Progress Board does have a project underway right now with the Oregon University Library System Consortium to start to do exactly that. We're going to put up a website with all of the data at the state level that we can find that's available at the county and the local level. So there will be one place for folks in all the counties to go to find the information the state has available. It's a long-term project, but it is, in fact, it's been up for about 6 months now. We do it with the Association of Oregon Counties, and it is something that's underway.
Jeff, do you think this is going to be something that might help you root out duplication of effort? Because we know we've got that. We've got the same stuff, maybe not specifically here, but if you're doing this for systems, you're going to find a whole lot of duplication, I would assume. So this will be a way that we can kind of look at streamlining too, then, I would assume.
Mr. Chair, I would hope that will be a side benefit of what happens. It's not the intent of the project, but I suspect that what you say will...
But if you notice it, you'll bring it to somebody's attention, I'm assuming.
Yes,
so.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Mona Sanders.
I want to thank you for bringing up that point regarding paperwork, because usually when we're working with the family support workers that are making the home visits, they want to deal with the families. They want to work on parenting issues. But they realize that most of their time is going to be spent filling out the form so we can get that information to the Oregon State. And it is true, but we have to go this route. Mm-hmm. Taxpayers want accountability, and the only way we have accountability is if we have measurable outcomes. So,
Representative, I would agree with that to a degree. I think for a lot of the reporting, it's bureaucrats that want accountability, not taxpayers.
Yeah.
That was kind of a political statement, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Thank you very much. We'll work on potential amendments for this bill, and I'm going to close the public hearing on 2643. Open a public hearing on 2644. Diane.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 2644 prohibits local commissions on children and families from providing direct services. I've given you some background information on what local commissions are about and their responsibilities and what they do. There are amendments to 2644 that would allow local commissions on children and families to provide direct services for children and families for a period of 6 months or less under circumstances where an emergency may terminate certain services in a county or region or where no other provider is able to deliver services. So
Okay.
And support promoters to provide direct services for a short time.
Okay, first on the list, Michael?
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Isn't that this? Should have just had you stay up here, I guess.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay, no problem.
Thank you again for the opportunity to give you some perspectives from Eastern Oregon. My name is Michael Sarine, Director of the Harney County Commission on Children and Families, and the same disclaimers apply about these are my comments. Very briefly, I'm not sure that this is a problem in the first place. I believe that there is a waiver process in place today. I understand there's only about six counties out of the 36 that are actually doing this. If that's not the case, and I personally believe that commissions should not be providing direct services, but I also believe in local control, and I know that at the local level, especially in small rural counties, that there is sometimes a necessity to do that. And the one comment about the specific wording of this bill, if you were to do this, the waiver statement in there about 6 months, I would argue that that should be 12 months or maybe even 24 months. If you look at, you know, when there's a need for that, it's because it's a small rural county, community, or county that just flat doesn't have the resources. It's not like you go to some agency and say, oh, could you do this for us? Generally, you have to go out and build from scratch a community group or an organization to do that. And it takes time, and I don't think 6 months would generally be enough time.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I wrote down a comment.
I'm just confused. Maybe my brain isn't working very well at 3 in the afternoon, but it says what the bill does is prohibits local commissions on children and families from providing direct services, and then it says, oh, the effect of the amendment.
Yeah, the amendment's right behind the SMS
okay,
there.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Barnhart.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who all we're going to hear from on this bill, and I don't. Maybe this isn't the right witness to ask this question of, but I'm wondering if it isn't possible that a different exception might work, and that would be an exception that has to do with county population. And I suggest this because it occurs to me that in the larger counties, at least, a rule like this, like the one we're talking about, not providing direct services, is actually a protection for community-based organizations already providing services. In smaller counties, the issue you're talking about may be much more important. And I'm wondering if maybe the way of solving this problem, instead of having a time limit for emergency situations, might not be perhaps a population limit or something of that sort.
Representative, I think that's a possibility. The problem, of course, is, as always, is where do you draw that line?
Well, of course,
and
yeah.
Then, I think having some, personally, I would think that having some limit on that would be good because it does force us to do stuff that might otherwise be hard or difficult to do, and that if we didn't have to do it, we'd just do it ourselves.
Ah, okay. Different kind of answer than I expected, but just the same
okay.
thing.
Just for the committee's benefit, if you look at the Dash 1 amendment, you can pretty much ignore the original bill.
Yes.
Because the Dash 1 amendment is a total replacement. So don't get confused between the two documents. So, any other questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just still having some confusion here. Can you give me an example of when this would apply with the Dash 1 amendment? Are you in support of the Dash 1 amendment?
If it had a larger minimum or time frame on it.
Okay. All right. So give me an example of when that would come into play.
Well, one could be, and I think this has happened in one of our rural counties where they got the CASA money, and there was no organization to do that. So the commission opted to hire that staff person and work it out of their office. So it was being provided as a direct service by the commission rather than under contract to some other agency or to a private nonprofit.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. We'll bring Donna up. She can maybe address some of these.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
May I just lay a question out, and whoever comes up to the table might want to answer it is welcome to.
Or they can ignore it altogether. Go ahead.
In paragraph B, on page 2, lines 1 through 8, basically says that notwithstanding paragraph A, that the local commission can provide a service if they determine there is an emergency, another provider discontinues, or no provider is able to offer services. What happens, because nowhere else am I seeing it in the statute, if at the end of 6 months, or 12 months, or 24 months, or whatever arbitrary time period we put in there, there is still not a provider? Can the local commission say, under this statute, that they have, well, they make findings again that there an emergency exists and that no provider is available, therefore they're going to continue to provide the services?
You want to take a shot?
Representative Cruz, once again, my name is Donna Middleton, Director of the Commission on Children and Families. Representative Cromwell, I don't think there is a good time period. I mean, it may be 6 months, it may be 3 years. The commission is in support of this bill. We have had a number of discussions with partners, with community members, around what is the purpose and responsibility of local commissions on children and families. And as you can see in this particular, and I'll get to your point, in this legislation, as you can see on page 1, it talks about informing citizens, identifying and mapping resources, looking and planning and advocating for research-based initiatives, developing local policies, priorities, measurable outcomes, prioritizing activities. I would suggest to you, I don't think they have time to run programs. However, local commissions were never put into statute to run programs. The state commission is prohibited from running programs, and I believe that the legislation was intended to mean both state and local commissions, and it got put in as the state commission not running programs. Local commissions are to facilitate and coordinate a process. And when the partners coming to your table believe that you have a vested interest in a piece of that process, it makes it much more difficult to facilitate a very neutral, a collaborative process when they believe that your interest is to receive resources from yourself to yourself. And so then you have this, are they there to facilitate what's in the best interest of the community? Are they to facilitate what might be in the best interest of a commission-led process? And I would suggest in some counties that becomes very difficult in bringing people to the table because they see the commission having a vested interest in what outcomes that process takes. And so we would like local commissions to be the neutral conveners and facilitators rather than the program operators. There's many, many places and communities that run programs that never was envisioned as a commission role and responsibility. I also support the 6 months because, and I can name many more communities than Mike just named that have issues. Deschutes County going through one right now where they have a Healthy Start program, which they call Ready, Set, Go, which currently was being operated by the community college, which is no longer going to be a community college. And so they went back to the commission.
That's an assumption, though.
Well, but according to them, they aren't. And so they went to the commission and said, we no longer can take your money for the Healthy Start, Ready, Set, Go program. The commission said, great, we'll bring it back in, and then we'll facilitate a process and bring in all the partners to see who could operate this kind of program, never intending to continue to run the program themselves. That's an example. What happens in counties, and Mike's right, when they have smaller communities, it's very difficult to find providers for some of these resources. However, the role of the commission is to do everything they possibly can to find those providers. And sometimes I think, and Mike said it well, it's easier to bring it in and not look for those providers very hard. I mean, so this would encourage communities to say, okay, maybe it's not a traditional provider. Maybe you go to the Boys and Girls Club, or maybe you look elsewhere for those kinds of things. This just allows the commission to be the neutral convener and facilitator, not the program operator, which I think is where they need to be if they're going to do the systems work and community mobilization work. Running programs is a full-time job. And quite frankly, that isn't what they were there for. And I know that it's a compliment to local commissions. The boards of commissioners go to them to say, I have a program, you know, can you help us develop a process for it, or can you operate it? And what we're trying to get them is out from the middle of having to be the operator of the program. Statutorily, they can now say, it's not our business. And I think that's a better place for them to be than where they are now in this never land of should I do it, should I don't, you know, those kinds of things. So we really support this because I think it is a better place. And also there isn't a lot of community commissions running programs. However, the ones that are running programs are having very difficult times with their partners around the facilitation and coordination of a systems approach.
Yeah. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about a commission that really loves the Healthy Start program, mm-hmm. and they've developed an advisory board, mm-hmm. and one commissioner, one person from the local commission, goes to the, say, partners' meetings and actually gives suggestions on how they should do things to deliver services. Do you think this is what's addressing that type of situation?
Chair Cruz, Representative Morris Anderson, I'm not sure that it does. What we're talking about is direct service, where I, as a commission, supervise a staff person who runs the Healthy Start program. If they want to sit on an advisory board to advise on a process of services and supports, I think that's fine.
Okay.
As long as they aren't seen as telling folks how to run the day-to-day operations of the program. So that's where you get the fine line. Another example is court-appointed special advocates, CASAs. CASAs are another program, and I'm, you know, like Healthy Start is for the commission. CASAs can receive money from the state commission directly, and then they also receive money from local commissions. This is not to say that they can't continue to receive those dollars from local commissions. What we're asking is that the local staff person of the commission not supervise the CASA director and that program. So it's a fine line, but it does get confusing when they do both.
Any other questions?
Just a real brief comment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, and that is, I appreciate Donna's comments, and what this actually is telling me, and as I read through it in my non-lawyer mind, because I'm not a lawyer, is that the commission, in order to be able to provide any services, which is fine, and I absolutely agree the commission shouldn't be providing any services, is that they have to make findings. And of their findings, they have to find, you know, at least two of the three things exist in order for them to,
right.
to be able to provide services. That's what it tells me. But that it can't, there's also not a provision for it to be able to go longer than 6 months. So they better find a provider within that 6 month period. That's what it tells me.
Representative, you're going to need to behave a little better now.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I don't want to. But.
Any other questions? Thank you, Donna. Jillian.
Chair Cruz and committee members, my name is Jillian Nicolaitis. I'm the director of the Commission on Children and Families in Douglas County. And I have a couple of experiences we've had that I'd like to share with you. But first I'd like to say that that the Commission's role is convener. And if we can't build trust in our communities as a neutral body, then what we do is we have a hard time bringing them to the table because they perceive us as a rival or, you know, an opponent for those services. And I just don't think that's where we want to be based on all the things that we should be doing. So I think the key is to make a plan for independence, and I'd like to talk about what we did. We had our CASA director who resigned suddenly, and I went to a meeting with our judge and my county commissioner, and they sat there helpless saying, what do we do? Does CASA just sit on the bench for 3 to 6 months? Do we try and figure these things out? Do we just kind of not have CASA for a while, and who's going to take over? We can't find anyone. And so, you know, I did raise my hand. I said, well, I would be willing to kind of nurture it for a while. I'd be willing to incubate it and make sure that it still exists, but I don't want to run it. But I would be willing to put together a group of people who, you know, quickly, who would put together something that would run CASA. And so I think also that what we did was we pulled a bunch of partners together. It's true that Douglas County is a medium-sized county, but what I'd like to say is every county has an ESD, every county has county services, every county has nonprofits and schools. So if you pull those people together, you can create something, I think, quickly. And I think the problem is if you don't do it quickly, what happens is you create a culture and people become dependent on the way things are at that point in time, and it's very, very hard to dismantle. So I would, you know, I would be a proponent for the Dash One Amendment to 6 months, and that is my reasoning. Even at 6 months, I ran it for 6 months, and it was really hard because I was administrator for CASA, I was running all the volunteers, I was trying to run everything, and at the same time I was trying to do my commission business. It's hard. We, in our office, we have 3 FTEs, and some commission offices they have 2 FTEs. How do you do that? You know, we also hired some people to oversee CASA, but it is a very hard job to do. And at the same time, how am I working with my people in the community to say I'm a neutral convener, but on the other hand, I'm running a service that needs to raise money and is in competition with other nonprofits? It's kind of an oxymoron to me. So I think there is a need sometimes when someone quits, like our CASA director did, for someone to come together and say someone needs to do something because this is something that's a critical service. But if no one's willing to come forward, you have to have some way to keep it going. But on the other hand, do something quick, because if you don't, you do create that culture where people, okay, they're already doing it. There is a county in our state who took over parts of Healthy Start 8 years ago on an emergency basis, and they're still doing it. I don't agree with that, because what that does is created a distrust in possibly certain communities that do that, because if they're providing services, then how can they be the neutral convener? So I guess that would be, you know, my argument, that in every county we do have ESDs, nonprofits, schools, and county services. I don't care, from the smallest county all on up, all counties have that. And I think if you're a good convener, I think ESDs, that's part of the role they play. They're talking about doing more integrated services. So I think that is a big role for ESDs, not for commissions.
I agree. Any questions? Thank you, Joanne.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2644. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2644. Representative Lee.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move the Dash One Amendment.
Representative Lee has moved the Dash One Amendment, House Bill 2644. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Discussion?
Just a real brief discussion point, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And that is, I would agree with what our witnesses have said from the standpoint that commissions should not be providing services. And I think that the Dash Ones do clarify it a little bit better than the original bill. So.
Any other discussion, Representative Tomei? No, I'm sorry.
That's me.
I'm Laura Sanders.
I knew that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope 6 months, it seems like we're pulling a number out of the sky. Six months, knowing how things progress, 6 months.
An ESD, every county has county services, every county has nonprofits and schools. So if you pull those people together, you can create something, I think, quickly. And I think the problem is if you don't do it quickly, what happens is you create a culture and people become dependent on the way things are at that point in time, and it's very, very hard to dismantle. So I would, you know, I would be a proponent for the Dash One Amendment to 6 months, and that is my reasoning. Even at 6 months, I ran it for 6 months, and it was really hard because I was administrator for CASA, I was running all the volunteers, I was trying to run everything, and at the same time I was trying to do my commission business. It's hard. We, in our office, we have 3 FTEs, and some commission offices they have 2 FTEs. How do you do that? And we also hired some people to oversee CASA, but it is a very hard job to do. And at the same time, how am I working with my people in the community to say I'm a neutral convener, but on the other hand, I'm running a service that needs to raise money and is in competition with other nonprofits? It's kind of an oxymoron to me. So I think there is a need sometimes when someone quits, like our CASA director did, for someone to come together and say, someone needs to do something because this is something that's a critical service. But if no one's going to come forward, you have to have some way to keep it going. But on the other hand, do something quick. Because if you don't, you do create that culture where people, okay, they're already doing it. There is a county in our state who took over parts of Healthy Start 8 years ago on an emergency basis, and they're still doing it. I don't agree with that. Because what that does is created a distrust in possibly certain communities that do that, because if they're providing services, then how can they be the neutral convener? So I guess that would be, my argument, that in every county we do have ESDs, nonprofits, schools, and county services. I don't care, from the smallest county all on up, all counties have that. And I think if you're a good convener, I think ESDs, that's part of the role they play. They're talking about doing more integrated services, so I think that is a big role for ESDs, not for commissions.
I agree. Any questions? Thank you, Joanne.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2644. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2644. Representative Lee.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move the Dash 1 amendment.
Representative Lee has moved the Dash 1 amendment. House Bill 2644. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Discussion?
Just a real brief discussion point, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And that is, I would agree with what our witnesses have said from the standpoint that commissions should not be providing services. And I think that the Dash 1s do clarify it a little bit better than the original bill. So. Okay.
Any other discussion, Representative Tomei? No, I'm sorry.
That's me.
I'm Lois Anderson.
I knew that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope 6 months, it seems like we're pulling a number out of the sky, six months, knowing how things progress. 6 months may be really short, but I get a little nervous that 6 months, if it takes a while to coordinate ESDs or schools, but I'm willing to go with the bill, but I still have that concern, is 6 months. What if it's 9 months? What if it's 12? But six is a goal, and what's the enforcement? So.
Well, that's true. I don't think anybody goes to jail over this.
No.
Representative Barnhart.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I guess my comment on that is that 6 months is probably way plenty, given at least the most recent comments we've heard, except for something, an emergency which started on June 15th, 3 months would probably be enough. But I think 6 months gives a little cushion.
Okay.
I would agree.
Any further discussion? Any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, the objection's approved. Or the amendment's approved. God, and it's only, what day of the week? It's only Thursday, isn't it?
No, it's Friday.
I got one more day to get through. Representative Crummell.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2644 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell has moved House Bill 2644 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Walker?
Yes.
Representative
Tomei?
Yes.
Representative
Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Excused.
Representative Lamont
Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair
Cruz? Aye. House Bill 2644, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Lee, are you wanting to carry this?
No, I was trying to suggest it go on the consent agenda.
I think I would object, Mr. Chair.
I think I would, too.
Let Mr. Crummell carry it.
I'll carry it if you'd like to.
Representative Carlson.
Oh, right, that would be different.
Or if not, we'll let Representative Crummell carry it, and I will close the work session on 2644, open work session on, or a public hearing on 2330. We better get this committee over before I fall apart. Diane.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 2330, in its current form, requires Oregon Commission on Children and Families to make available grants for youth investment and family preservation, modifies the uses of children's services grants as determined by local commissions on children and families. You have dash one and dash two amendments. Within those amendments, the amendments delete the juvenile services grants, and they delete the student retention initiative grants, and then create the family system development initiative. It creates local planning and capacity building grants to be used to fund the operations of local commissions on children and families to develop and mobilize communities. It revises language for federal the Family Preservation Support Services Program to allow receipt of Title IV-B to federal funds. And it removes system change efforts and examples of non-stigmatizing programs from page 2 of the bill. Now, in the dash 1 amendments on page 2, line 22 through 27, those amendments are similar to the dash 2 amendments. However, they, on the dash 1 amendments, grant family preservation and support grants for non-stigmatizing programs. However, the dash 2 amendments that are from Services to Children and Families talk about families at risk or in crisis. So there are some differences. We also, in the dash 1 amendments in that same subsection 5, have the family preservation and support grants will be used to fund community strategies as determined at the local level by local commissions on children and families. That language, determined at the local level by local commissions on children and families, does not exist in the dash 2 amendments.
Okay. Mike?
Sure.
You're first on the list.
Oh.
I'm hoping to get more information on this from Jennifer.
Okay. Just a minute.
When I gave you my staff measure summary, and I indicated on my staff measure summary that I was providing you with the attached rules that the State Commission on Children and Families uses, has established for these grants, and then I never gave them to you. And I apologize, so I'm giving them to you now. And please note that the governor's budget reallocates the funds for these programs, they reallocate these funds, these grants, to the Oregon Children's Plan that focuses 0-8. So some of these grants are already going away.
Go ahead.
Mike Sarine, Director of the Harney County Commission on Children and Families from Burns. Same disclaimers. This is going to be a little difficult because I haven't been able to really look at, think about these amendments. The original draft of 2330, I think I would approve of. And the Coalition of County Commissions on Children and Families is on record as saying that, you know, we would like to see the juvenile services and the SRI grants restored or not taken in the first place for the same reasons that we've stated that the last two legislatures when the same things have gone on, and that is those are, especially the juvenile services, are only really flexible funds, and they're funds that serve the entire age range, 0-18. And when we lose those funds, we lose local control, we lose flexibility, we lose programs. And that's an important point. Again, this may seem like a small point maybe to Multnomah County or Washington County, where a 56% cut, say, in juvenile services might result in a reduction of a program. In most of the small rural counties, it will result in the elimination
of programs. We will lose programs and resources altogether. And as we do that, we also lose partners, and partnerships and relationships get strained. And it doesn't make it any easier to do our job. With regard to the amendments, based on what little bit I've been able to read and understand in just the last few minutes, the one problem I see with the creation of the
Family System Development Initiative.
Family System Development thing is, if you read in there, it says it changes the focus to young children. That means it's going from 0 to 18 to, I don't know, 0 to 6 or 0 to 8. And that's the same problem we've had with, you know, them trying to take juvenile services in the past. The same thing's true. So I guess without being more knowledgeable about that, I have some reservations about those amendments. But like the original piece of 23.3.
Any questions?
Well, just to be certain I understand, you believe that the bill as printed, without any amendments, is acceptable?
Yes, I like it.
Okay, but if I follow you correctly, you're concerned that the amendments restrict the use of the funds to the point where some of existing programs might not be sustainable any longer. If I follow you correctly.
Yes. Okay. But to me, it really changes kind of the whole flavor or intent of the bill. It's a different direction.
Thank you.
Another question. Thank you very much. Peg? Well, I'm not sure I agree with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I, too, am a little bit confused because I read the bill as it was originally and didn't have the information until just about a half hour ago on the changes in that bill. I guess the statements that I would blanket here would be that I believe that in Wallowa County, it's important that local decision-making is supported through the allocation of targeted, flexible funding resources, however that might come about. Our juvenile service grant stream is a flexible fund and allows us to target populations from 0 to 18, and that's an important opportunity for us in our county. We hate to see the student retention initiative go away. I believe it's in the governor's budget to do that, though. With our declining school enrollment, our current student retention initiative dollars are minimal, but we were getting big bang for the buck, so to speak. In one of our school districts, if I was to flunk an English class, then I would turn around and have to pay $65, and I would go to the alternative school, and I'd make that English credit up. In that Wallowa school system, the dropout rate is 0%. It picks a kid up initially when they start to falter in any subject, and it gives them the opportunity to make that up so they're back on track to graduate with their course credits. The student retention initiative dollars have allowed us to have that kind of a program, and without that, with our school declining enrollment, I think Wallowa School lost 40 kids this last year with the closing of our third mill in our county. We do not currently have great starts in our community. And I do believe that there needs to be consideration as we move into this new community mobilization role where we're developing family system initiatives that focus on families with young children and their siblings. Dollars for implementation and operation of those strategies are important to our system in some form, whether this be the way that it's designed. Like I said, I haven't had enough time to look it over.
Okay, I guess. I guess my confusion here at this point is it eliminates some specific. It eliminates some specific grant streams,
yes.
but it leaves all of the decision making at the local level, so that can still happen if the local folks want it to happen. So nothing's been eliminated except specific language. I mean, the money still comes, and the local commission decides what happens with the money. So
as long as there's flexibility for those dollars to go toward the programs that those dollars were funding before, and it isn't just community mobilization.
That flexibility is not removed.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, I don't know. I was confused about it when it came up, so I was hoping there might be some clarity.
Okay. Scott, do you want to come up and speak to this?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Johnson. I am the director of the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families, and I would like to speak to House Bill 2330 very briefly. A couple of things for context. This is our third run through working on a comprehensive plan for our county, and we very much engage the community in that process, and one consistent theme in that is maximum flexibility in the availability of resources so that you can really look and identify community needs and have a direct relationship between you, the planning that you do at a community level and the way you invest in kids. I see some real promise in the amendments in the sense of providing flexibility and bundling resources. This has taken various forms. We have been here in prior sessions advocating more for a block grant approach with some clear outcomes and accountabilities. I see this very consistent. My only caution would be with respect to the language that says make grants to fund family system development initiatives that focus on families with young children and their siblings. And I must tell you, speaking specifically for Deschutes County, in 1995 and again in 97, with the support of the legislature, we actively pursued waivers to move more of our resources towards younger children. So we have been before this body in prior sessions trying to reflect a commitment from the community to do more investment with younger children. Generally speaking, this would be language that would be very favorable, consistent with what we would try and do, the kind of thing that we would want to do. I am a little troubled in this environment with the Oregon Children's Plan, seeing cuts in a number of areas, and having some consternation about losing the flexibility to work with kids more in elementary and maybe early middle school years. So I do believe here in representing our county commissioners and our Commission on Children and Families, we are supportive of the young children orientation. We use the waivers to do that, including some funds from the Oregon Youth Authority. So that is good language. It may be better to go more with language that says family system development initiatives that focus on families, that perhaps leave it there. Again, not to discourage people from focusing on young children. We do believe as a matter of policy, the more we can drive resources to younger children, that is desirable. But in this environment where we're looking at cuts in some grant streams, we also need the flexibility to do what we need to do consistent with our coordinated comprehensive plan to help kids in the elementary and early middle school years. So I do think this is a very healthy direction, is worthy of support. The only caution I would have is around the young children language. You may want to allow more flexibility. Again, with the accountability coming, that have we really researched what's needed in the community, and is that really the best investment at a local level?
So, Scott, if we just cut it off at families, that still gives you all the flexibility you need to go wherever you want.
Yes, and I do honestly believe much, yes, Representative Cruz, and I do believe much of our attention would be with younger children anyhow, but I do think, honestly, what our community is saying is we cannot concentrate on that completely at the expense of what we need to do in another age group area. And we are facing more constraints, at least as it's reflected in the governor's budget.
Okay, with that elimination, you would support the dash one.
Yes, sir.
What about the dash two? I mean, do you prefer that section five or the section five and the dash one? Not that I'm putting you on the spot or anything, but...
To be very honest, Mr. Chairman, I'm not... I would need help in understanding the distinction between the two.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, thank you. Any other questions, Scott? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would either one of these bills, the original bill or the dash ones, require you to substantially change your current comprehensive plan?
I think potentially, excuse me, Representative Crummell, Mr. Chair, I believe it could enhance the planning. Anything that would provide us with greater flexibility, I believe, is a step in the right direction. In our particular case, the way we're structured in Deschutes County, we manage resources from the Oregon Youth Authority, Department of Human Services, Criminal Justice Commission, and Commission on Children and Families. It is an extremely challenging process to manage more than 20 grants, sometimes with complementary, sometimes with conflicting expectations. I do read, from my understanding of this, I see it as potentially providing more flexibility, and I would urge that. Again, I don't think flexibility means a lack of accountability. I think we should absolutely be accountable, but the more resources can be bundled, and you can be insisting that we follow the local planning and local data, I think that will be the best for you and the best for our community.
Any other questions? Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Committee, just so you'll know, this bill did not come with a subsequent referral, but we are going to refer it to Ways and Means because these are some vital programs, and this bill does need to be down there so that we can make sure that this funding continues to go where it's supposed to.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I have a question. You were on the interim committee, weren't you?
Yeah.
House interim. So I'm just confused. Why was this bill introduced for... What was it trying to correct?
It was trying to correct another direction that other groups were working towards. Basically, the bills we've been hearing the last couple days and next week, the direction we are attempting to go is to make sure that the direction we set out with in 99 with Senate Bill 555 gets continued. 555 had specific funding streams. It had specific commitments to local folks and specific commitments to allowing them plan development and the ability to control program. We were hearing that there were other folks that thought we maybe ought to be shifting direction or having control shifted to other places, and it was our desire to continue the commitment we had made to local communities that they would be driving the process and that the funding we had given them for program development would still be there. So that's where all of this basically came from.
Okay, thank you. That helps me understand.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
I have a question from to you, Mr. Chair. Because I don't know where these grants are coming from, but I think some of them are federal grants, or are they all federal grants that they're talking about, like the...
I'll have Representative Carlson come up and speak to the chart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have that chart?
Well, if you would pull out the spreadsheet that I gave you, it was on the very back of that packet
when I
testified on a prior bill.
555 one?
It was with the Marion County RFP.
2643.
Right. Rachel has some extra copies in case you don't want to dig it out.
In fact, I slipped through to the other package.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I recognize that this is confusing, and Representative Winters actually asked me to help draft these amendments on behalf of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. We just finished discussion on the State Commission's budget, and we're hearing some other budgets, but before we go to work session, but one of the things that we're looking at in that budget is that if you take a look at this spreadsheet, is that over time, actually since about 1979, the commissions on children and families have little by little received different pots of money from different sources, some federal, some general fund. The ones that you see on the first six columns of your spreadsheet are general fund sources, juvenile services, great start, student retention, and you've seen those in the bill. There's one that's not in statute that's allowed for local staffing is what it's called, and that came in 1993 when two staff were mandated for the local commissions. The youth investment, you can see that in two places. It's in the third column from the total columns. You see youth investment other funds and youth investment general fund backfill. So almost a third, I guess, if you look at it, of the youth investment funds are general fund, and then the rest is other funds, and that's federal that comes from another agency. And then family preservation and support has been the same way. There's federal funds that are supplemented by general fund. And child care is not included in this because even though it's somewhat flexible, it's flexible in the sense you can use it for different child care initiatives, but you have to use it for child care. It's federal money. So just ignore that column. So what we've been looking at is that the governor's budget cuts 56% of the juvenile services commission, the juvenile services dollars out of the governor's recommended budget. Great Start is increased a little bit. Student retention initiative is zeroed out. Local staffing is increased somewhat. And the family preservation and support general fund backfill is eliminated. So that leaves us with the dilemma about we've got half of a funding stream, no funding stream that's in statute, the general fund money gone from one. And as we were talking in committee about the different funding streams, it was obvious that a number of the members on the committee were saying, look at all of these different funding streams, and wouldn't it be easier to put it together into something that was a little bit more, flexible, but also didn't have so many different accountability lines so that it actually bundle them together, as Scott was talking about. I know that local commissions have very complex and intricate spreadsheets that they keep behind the scenes as they mix and match these dollars to fund programs, and it's becoming harder and harder as more funding streams have been given to them. Another dilemma that I just know from working in the field is that the local staffing money is not adequate to fund 2 FTE. In 1994, and if Gordon, he's not still here from AOC, but Gordon Foltz was a key player. I remember him running around looking harried during the 93 session about this. They determined what two staff in a county would cost, and then they shaved off about, $2 million and then gave them the balance, as we are inclined to do in our body, And so what they've had to do is the administrative rules allow you to shave off an extra 10% on these other for administration, 2% for evaluation, another percentage for coordination. So again, the dollars get mixed and matched to do the staffing and the community mobilization efforts that you heard about before. So in small counties, what that means is that you set up, because you can't pay for your 2 FTE out of local staffing money, as you shave down the program money, there's this tension between the program providers and the county commissioners that want to fund the programs with program money, and the need to fund at least two people in an office to do the planning and the community development and the service integration work. And so that's always been a dilemma. So what we were hoping to do was to perhaps have a local operations and capacity building, this whole idea of community mobilization and development, a fund that was larger that would allow them to do that so that they wouldn't get in fights with the county commissioners and program providers all the time, that it would be designated that it's for that purpose. And then a family system pot of money that would be allowed to do these systems change effort, like family resource centers, that aren't just for young children, but that are for families, that are broader. Relief nurseries might fit in a Great Start program. Family resource centers, if they deal with children over 8 years old, could not be funded with Great Start money. And with the juvenile services money being ratcheted down, it becomes more and more difficult to fund those holistic family center types of programs. So this takes all these little funding streams and basically bundles it into early childhood money, family money, and community mobilization money. And then the youth investment stays the same because that's federal and targeted to youth. And the family preservation, let me explain that one because that question came out. When I sent down the initial amendment, I had a telephone discussion with SCF. The State Commission, as I understand it, has, and SCF also, because we heard it this morning, is being audited by the federal government about our use of family preservation and support dollars. In 1995, when we had the plan approved,
for the local commissions. The youth investment, you can see that in two places. It's in the, I guess, the third column from the total columns. You see youth investment other funds and youth investment general fund backfill. So almost a third, I guess, if you look at it, of the youth investment funds are general fund, and then the rest is other funds. And that's federal that comes from another agency. And then family preservation and support has been the same way. There's federal funds that are supplemented by general fund. And child care is not included in this because even though it's somewhat flexible, it's flexible in the sense you can use it for different child care initiatives, but you have to use it for child care. It's federal money. So just ignore that column. So what we've been looking at is that the governor's budget cuts 56% of the juvenile services commission, the juvenile services dollars out of the governor's recommended budget. Great Start has increased a little bit. Student retention initiative is zeroed out. Local staffing has increased somewhat. And the family preservation and support general fund backfill is eliminated. So that leaves us with a dilemma about we've got half of a funding stream, no funding stream that's in statute, the general fund money gone from one. And as we were talking in committee about the different funding streams, it was obvious that a number of the members on the committee were saying, look at all of these different funding streams, and wouldn't it be easier to put it together into something that was a little bit more, you know, flexible, but also didn't have so many different accountability lines so that we'd actually bundle them together, as Scott was talking about. I know that local commissions have very complex and intricate spreadsheets that they keep behind the scenes as they mix and match these dollars to fund programs, and it's becoming harder and harder as more funding streams have been given to them. Another dilemma that I just know from working in the field is that the local staffing money is not adequate to fund 2 FTE. In 1994, and Gordon, he's not still here from AOC, but Gordon Foltz was a key player. I remember him running around looking harried in the 93 session about this. They determined what two staff in a county would cost, and then they shaved off about, you know, $2 million and then gave them the balance, as we are inclined to do in our body, you know. And so what they've had to do is the administrative rules allow you to shave off an extra 10% on these other for administration, 2% for evaluation, another percentage for coordination. So, again, the dollars get mixed and matched to do the staffing and the community mobilization efforts that you heard about before. So in small counties, what that means is that you set up, because you can't pay for your 2 FTE out of local staffing money, as you shave down the program money, there's this tension between the program providers and the county commissioners that want to fund the programs with program money, and the need to fund at least two people in an office to do the planning and the community development and the service integration work. And so that's always been a dilemma. So what we were hoping to do was to perhaps have a local operations and capacity building, this whole idea of community mobilization and development, a fund that was larger that would allow them to do that so that they wouldn't get in fights with the county commissioners and program providers all the time, that it would be designated that it's for that purpose, and then a family system pot of money that would be allowed to do these systems change efforts like family resource centers that aren't just for young children but that are for families that are broader. Relief nurseries might fit in a Great Start program. Family resource centers, if they deal with children over 8 years old, could not be funded with Great Start money. And with the juvenile services money being ratcheted down, it becomes more and more difficult to fund those holistic family-centered types of programs. So this takes all these little funding streams and basically bundles it into early childhood money, family money, and community mobilization money. And then the youth investment stays the same because that's federal and targeted to youth. And the family preservation, let me explain that one because that question came out. When I sent down the initial amendment, I had a telephone discussion with SCF. The State Commission, as I understand it, has, and SCF also, because we heard it this morning, is being audited by the federal government about our use of family preservation and support dollars. In 1995, when we had the plan approved, Oregon was sort of at the forefront of using these Title IV B Subpart 2 funds, and this is to preserve families and keep them from going into the foster care system. So we were using them for all kinds of non-stigmatizing parenting, respite care, relief nurseries, CASA, those types of things. With the Adoption and Safe Families Act, and the idea that now children need to be moved very quickly through the child welfare system, child protective services system, into permanent placements, the federal government is more and more wanting states to focus those dollars on families that are at imminent risk of going, of their children going into foster care. And so some of these more broad-based prevention programs are no longer acceptable to the federal government. So what SCF has done is they've sent over the Dash 2 amendment, which came later than the First Amendment, which I sent down to council, and this is their proposed language for what that funding stream ought to say based on their experience with the auditors from the federal government. So you'll notice that it talks about families at risk or in crisis. It's much more targeted than the language that we had in the original bill or the language that I proposed that sort of took out the examples and took out the systems change efforts and just made it for families to successfully nurture their children. That's a much more preventive language, and the concern of SCF and the State Commission, and they can speak for themselves, but this is what they told me, is that they're concerned that we would be in violation of those federal auditors and the federal regulations if we continue to use the money the same way that we have been doing in the past. The only thing that I might suggest to you, and I don't know if you could do this conceptually, is that you do the as determined at the local level by local commissions on children and families. You tack that onto the end of it so that it would follow the parallel language that we're using in each one of these funding streams, so that it would make that determination according to the local plan by local commissions. And, of course, the local plans have to be approved by boards of county commissioners and the state commission, and the state commission would not approve a plan if it was in violation of the federal regulations. So there's no danger of a local commission sort of thumbing their nose and saying, you know, we'll do what we will, because there is an approval process that goes through with the plan. So hopefully that clarifies some of your questions. Doesn't clarify me.
Well, yeah, that's in Mona Sanderson.
Help me through this in trying to, I guess I need to know first, the State Commission on Children and Families, I thought, was only to deal with ages 0 through 8.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, no. The intent of the Children's Care Team and the intent of House Bill 2004 was that the commissions were to deal with all ages. And, in fact, there is a wellness model that's in the Care Team report that you got that shows the different ages and stages. The emphasis was to be on prevention. Prevention can be done at any age. It is not just with young people. You will hear some differences in interpretation from folks who were around that original table, and even today, you know, folks that some claim that the commissions are supposed to just be about young children, but the statute does not say that, nor does the care team report say that. And I think if you talk to most people who work in local commissions, they see their role as being about the entire continuum of children and families.
And the other question I have for you is there, and this is a policy question, putting federal funding streams into Oregon statute, federal funds are very flexible, and sometimes we'll have them and sometimes we won't. Putting them into statute just doesn't seem appropriate.
We do it all the time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I had heard that argument prior to this meeting, so I did some research. And Title 19 grants are in statute. Community Action Agency gets housing grants. They're in statute. They go to community action agencies. There are alcohol and drug grants that go to counties. There are a number of different parallels that we have. These do not specifically, the youth investment grants, the feds don't call it youth investment. They call it, it comes from Title 20, Social Services Block Grant Funding. So the funding source is not listed here. It's simply listed by what the purpose of the grants is to the county. So, and as I mentioned earlier, the feds have been ratcheting that money back over the last 7 to 8 years, and the legislature has been routinely backfilling those funds with general funds so that large portions of those grants now are partially federal but also partially general funded. So there's nothing to say that the legislature could not continue to fund those if the federal money went away. There's also nothing to say that if the federal money goes away in 5 or 6 years, we couldn't come back and delete those sections from statute at that time, as it would seem appropriate.
What we would do is if something disappears and we
make that adjustment.
You know, if something appears, we adjust. If something disappears, we adjust. That's why we meet every 2 years. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons, other than just to get away from home, I guess. Any other questions? Thank you, Janet. We've got a problem here, committee, and our problem is if we adopt the dash ones, we then have no place to adopt the dash twos, because the dash twos refer to the original bill, and once we've adopted the dash ones, the original bill disappears, and then the reference in the dash twos is no longer relevant. If we adopt the dash twos first, and then adopt the dash ones. We've eliminated the dash twos. So we're gonna need to do some logistical things here. Representative Walker.
Can't we, all in one process here, adopt the measure first and then amend it? I mean, the bill first and then amend it. Instead of adopting the bills and then, I mean, the amendments and then going back to the bill.
If we adopt the bill, okay.
The dash ones.
And then we adopt the dash ones, which basically eliminates the bill. Okay. The reference in the dash twos are to the original bill, so mm-hmm. so the reference is
I
no
understand.
Longer applicable. So we're going to have to come back on this because you know I, at one point I was thinking we don't do the dash twos, but if there is some federal accountability there, I think it's something. Mm-hmm. Do we? Okay, tell us, let's find out what would happen.
The agency is
if we don't do the dash two, is there another way to get a requirement without that?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm the Assistant Administrator at State Office for Services to Children and Families. I am not certain in terms of your parliamentary procedure here in terms of could we amend the dash ones so that we could fold the dash two language into it and then move the rest of the language into the bill. I don't know that.
Well, the problem with the dash two says on page two of the printed bill, delete line 1-6, which we can't do. If we adopt the dash ones, then there is no line 1-6 on page two.
Correct, Mr.
Because
Chairman.
Then we're dealing with.
But it's replaced by the language that's in page two of the dash ones on numbers 22 through 27, those lines. So we need to make an amendment to this new section 5.
Ooh. Okay, let me throw this at you. Let's go to the dash one. On section 5, on line 26, and after it, okay, where it says, well, line 25, eliminate all, and so, and then after families,
after families, insert
who are at risk or in crisis.
And I believe you need to delete the word all.
Okay. So it would say funding community strategies for children and their families who are at risk or in crisis as determined at the local level.
Yes, that, Mr. Chairman.
Does that cover it?
I think that would fix it.
Does everyone
get the answer to
that? Well, if I recall correctly, one of the other witnesses earlier was objecting to the language on line 9 of page 1.
Yes, well, yeah.
And is that also part of what you're thinking about changing? Okay, all right.
Okay. I think we'll pass it conceptually. I get in so much trouble. Okay, any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Yeah, I find this, Mr. Chair, very confusing, and I... just the funding streams and the role of the State Commission and the other agencies that might be involved, and what parameters do these other agencies have? Would they be the... I mean, I'm just not comfortable until I... I just need some time on this.
We're about to lose.
Well, no, what's the comfort level of the rest of the committee on this?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would be a lot more comfortable if we had a dash three that encompassed all of these changes. It gave Representative Mona Sanderson a chance to look at the income stream and think a little bit more about the issue of how this bill impacts the issues that Representative Carlson raised around putting different income streams together and what the impact of that's likely to be on the existing and potential programs. It's just an awful lot to absorb in a few minutes' time this afternoon, for me as well.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2330 and adjourn.